God, if
you... I'd like to call the meeting to order for the Goleta City Planning Commission for today, March 14th. And if you would please all join me in the Pledge of Allegiance. Stand and join us. Ready, begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, thank you very much. Everybody could have their seats. So, Madam Clerk, if you could do the roll call for us, please.
Commissioner Daniels?
Present.
Commissioner Fuller?
Present.
Commissioner Maynard?
Present.
Vice Chair Jenkins?
Here.
Chair Onan?
Here.
Thank you.
Okay, so at this juncture, we are going to do our public forum, which is an opportunity for anyone to speak on any item within this jurisdiction of the City of Goleta that is not on tonight's agenda, and you get to come up first. Did we have any more speaker slips for the public forum? Okay, so I do have one speaker slip. Lisi Christensen.
Hi, it's Lisa Christensen.
Lisa.
Good evening, City Council members and audience. As I was putting together my thoughts for this evening meeting, I was reminded that we would not be discussing the RV ordinance of the Goleta homeowners private property. So as you can see by the small audience in numbers, that this is a very hot topic for the month. So moving on, I ask that you, is this a city that should be renamed as a neighborhood improvement program to the neighborhood intrusion program? Just food for thought. Before I came here tonight, I had just finished reading the monthly Rotary magazine and thought about the article I had just read, an article about leadership versus followers. A good follower must be engaged in an active collaboration with the leader, and that requires critical thinking. Followers must be candid with supervisors, especially in offering constructive criticism that might aid in larger causes. And that brought me to this, the Rotary four-way test. Some of you may be familiar with that. Is it the truth? Is it fair to all concerned? Will it build goodwill and better friendships? Will it be beneficial to all concerned? In closing, please do not infringe upon the liberties of others. If you have an issue, address that specifically. But don't infringe upon the liberties of others on private property rights who do try and abide by good neighborly conduct by social contact. It seems like we're constantly overreaching on laws for things that don't need to be fixed. Thank you, and above all else, we want to live in a city that values the rights of people to the peaceful, uninterrupted enjoyment of our private properties. Please consider the new zoning laws that you're considering to not pass. I thank you very much.
Thank you. All right, so still our only speaker for the public forum. So let's move on to our next item. Do we have any amendments or adjustments to tonight's agenda? None?
No.
Okay. Excuse me just a moment, just catching up here on the speaker slips. Okay. So let's go into our administrative agenda tonight, which is approval of our minutes for the last three meetings. As you recall from the last meeting, we did delay going through some of them so that everybody had a chance to go through those. And if we can, let's take them one at a time. Item A1, does anybody have any comments on those minutes? That's from the February 22nd. Wait, is
February 8th?
Or February 8th.
February 8th.
Yes. I'm on, yes, my mistake. February 8th.
Mr. Chair, I would move to approve with the amendments that staff made, and I appreciate their efforts on that.
I second.
The commission has any other amendments they wish to offer.
Okay, so we have a first and a second. Any other discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Looks unanimous. Let's move on to A2, which is the minutes for the meeting of February 22nd. Any comments on those minutes? If none, the chair will entertain a motion.
I would move to approve the minutes of February 22nd.
I would second.
All right, we have first and a second. Last chance at comment or discussion. Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Unanimous again on the approval of the minutes for the 22nd. And then we have our final administrative item, A3. And before we do this, I have a request to speak to this item.
To the minutes?
That's what it says.
Yes. Hmm. That's me.
All right. Well, would you, Sandy?
Yeah.
Kovanda?
Yes.
Please come on up.
Hello, I'm Sandy Kovanda. I was a speaker at the meeting that you're talking about. I guess it was February 29th. Anyways, I looked at the minutes, and I think you did a wonderful job at putting all my points, but there was one that was missed. So you missed the point that I said if our buildings, if there was a fire or an earthquake and we had to rebuild our buildings, I was concerned that the antenna would interfere, it would restrict our private property from rebuilding, because right now it's the antenna is 35 feet away from our building, but we could possibly build closer than that because our private property is much closer. It's only like 5 feet away. And so that was my comment that was left out of, like I said, unit 1 and 7, we couldn't put like a second story on it because of the way that the waves go through from the RF exposure. So that was the only thing that was left out of the minutes.
Okay.
So I was hoping that maybe you could add that in, but they look really good.
All right. Can I ask staff, have we captured that addition to the minutes? Yes? Okay.
Thank you very much.
So we have at least one edit to the minutes. Is there any other changes from the commission? Mm-hmm. All right. Do we have a motion?
I move that we accept the minutes with the correction and addition.
Okay.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. Any other discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Aye. Mr. Chair, I'd like to know when the continuance is good for. How long we...
On that item from last meeting?
Yes. When do we hear it again? Please.
We'll just accept. So we had a unanimous approval of the minutes. So a question from Mr. Daniels.
If that it was not continued to a date certain, therefore it will be re-noticed when it's ready to come back to you.
Can I ask a follow-up on that?
Please.
Thank you.
I know we're on a time clock on this one. Was an agreement made that we'll have an extended time?
Not at this time.
Okay. Are we at fear of running out of that time?
Not at this time.
Thank you.
Okay, so now let's go to our workshop item. Madam Clerk, do you need to read that item into the record? Please do so.
Item B1 is a public hearing. It's the review of the draft zoning ordinance, Part 4, regulations applying to multiple districts.
All right, so I think we start with the staff.
Good evening, Chair and Commissioners. As you know, after 2 years or a little more than that now of working on our zoning ordinance, we have since released the public review draft zoning ordinance last November, and we are now at our fifth workshop as we're doing a page turn. of our zoning ordinance. Since November, we've had two open houses, and the next one is April 7th from 6 to 8 p.m. here in the council chambers. So we hope to see people, even people who were here before. I think thoughts change over time. New information is heard at these meetings, and so we're always looking forward to the public's input in this process. We've had more stakeholder meetings, as we have since, I think our first one was in December, and we had more stakeholder meetings in already since our last meeting on February 22nd to discuss zoning ordinance, and those have been very, very helpful. Again, the stakeholder meetings are encouraged, and people can call 961-7548. It's on GaletaZoning.com as well, and to set up a meeting with staff. And so we typically pull our zoning staff together along with the planning director and sometimes with our consultant so that we can really get a better understanding about what groups' issues may have with zoning in general. Even if you don't understand something and you just want to meet with us just to ask questions, or help us walk through how to use the zoning regulations, that's what we're here for. So we encourage the stakeholder meetings. And we've gotten a lot out of the stakeholder meeting process as well. So GaletaZoning.com, that's where you sign up to get on our mailing list. That's how you get your email blasts, or one of the ways. There's a few different ways, but that's a sure way of getting an email blast for when we do updates on the project, when we have our next meeting, when packets are released. And so we're always encouraging people to sign up. We just released a new question and answer on the FAQ page on the website. There are questions like, why are we proposing changes to our zoning? Will the general plan be changed as a part of this process? Who can participate in this process? How do we comment on the process? What is the process? Those are some of the questions that we've included to kind of help better guide the public into where we're at in the process as well. So we'll continue to update that on at a regular basis to help the public. And so we very much encourage you to use the website and also to give us feedback. We really appreciate that. We've had some comments about providing information on our website, and there were great requests, and we immediately jumped on that, got stuff loaded up on our website, like the general plan, EIR, and that is now on the zoning website as opposed to just the city's website. So we're trying to listen and make sure that we're getting things up to date. So let's see, with that background, maybe just one other thing. I think I touch on this each time, but what staff's doing after these workshops is we have meetings, team meetings with a consultant, and we're going over public comment, which we keep in a binder. So we have a few different copies of it, but there's one at the public counter. There's one right now that's out on the on the counter when you walk in the foyer. But it's available to the public if they wish. There's a log of the public comment and the letters that are numbered, that the ones that you have on your desk. Anyway, so we review the comment letters that we've received. We review the input that's been provided, and then we start working on what you'll see after we're done with this page turn, which is a revised version based on the direction that you've provided and the input that we've received from the public. So the best that we can to start loading up your next version of the draft zoning ordinance. So that's kind of where we're at, so we never stop working on it. We're not just going forward, we're also going backwards and from the last meeting catching up so that we're on top of things and we don't let things slip through the cracks. But the things like the minutes help us, so we appreciate the time that you spend with the minutes, certainly. So I think with that, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Martha Miller, and she's going to walk you through the material that's in your packet that we released a couple weeks ago and that is going to be reviewed tonight. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chair and members of the Commission. I'll just go through a quick summary of the topics that we'll be discussing tonight, but really try and save the majority of the time for your discussion. And just, again, reminding us why the city embarked upon this effort of the new zoning ordinance is to really create a zoning ordinance that works for the city. Again, when the city incorporated, it adopted the county's ordinance, and this is the first time that the city would have an ordinance that really responds to and implements the city's general plan. And we're continuing the discussion of part four of the zoning ordinance, which is regulations that apply in multiple districts. And we introduced it the last time, but didn't get to the point of discussing the oil and gas facilities chapter. And this is really more a carrying forward of the regulations that exist, that are in existence today. And they have regulations for onshore and offshore oil and gas facilities, the permit requirements, development standards, specific standards for pipelines, and then abandonment and removal procedures. At the last meeting, we did discuss the recreational vehicle parking, but we didn't get to the balance of the parking and loading section, and that has parking ratios, which is the parking spaces that are required for certain uses that you're required to provide. It has provisions for parking reductions based on certain characteristics, such as transit accessibility. If there's shared parking, there's parking reductions available specific to the Old Town District for redevelopment and for some restaurants. And then there can be other reductions based on a case-by-case review. There's standards regarding the location of parking, bicycle parking, on-site loading, and then parking area design and development standards, which talks about the surfacing, the landscaping that's required, striping, dimensions, all those factors that go into the design of parking areas. The next chapter is on performance standards, and this really looks at limiting nuisances, hazards, objectional conditions. In general, it really serves that you can't provide or create a noxious or dangerous environment, and it specifically addresses air quality, liquid and solid waste, hazardous materials, noise, fumes, smoke, and so on. The next section is signs, which has a number of standards that really relate to the amount and the type of signage that is allowable per use and in different districts. And it really starts out with categories of signs that are exempt from the sign standards in there. Then there's categories of signs that are prohibited within the city of Goleta. There are sign design principles. And then there's general provisions for all signs. So there's certain things that all signs need to adhere to. Then there's sign standards by district. So each of the different zoning districts within the city will have certain allowances for the types of sign and the area of sign that they can have. And then there's specific allowances for specific uses, including agricultural operations, which is a carry forward from the existing. There's allowances for non-residential uses in residential districts. Service and gas stations have some specific sign allowances, as well as cinemas. And then there's standards for specific sign types. Typically, the number that you can have, the size, the height. So if it's a wall sign, you know, there's a height limit to that. There's a certain projection that you can have from the wall. If it's a sign that projects from a building, there's a certain clearance that it has to have so that people can walk underneath it. So there's different standards that are tied specifically to different types of signs. Then there's also a requirement in some cases, an allowance in others, for a master sign program. And these are the programs where there's a sign program that identifies the type, the location, the design of signs. It's like an integrated sign program for developments with multiple occupancies or large developments. And through that master sign program, there is an ability to request modifications to sign standards, and that's reviewed on a case-by-case basis through DRB and the Planning Commission. And then there's provisions for non-conforming signs, how they can be continued and maintained, definition of when something is abandoned or not, when does that sign need to be removed, and then the provisions for when a sign can be restored or non-conforming sign can be restored. And then finally, in a fairly large section, is the standards for specific uses and activities. So these are standards for certain uses that by the nature, their characteristics and their nature of their operation or development have some standards to address potential compatibility issues. And this would apply wherever that use is located. And generally, the types of uses that have these specific standards are auto-related uses, looking at building and site design, loading, circulation, landscaping and screening. There's commercial-related uses, length of stay for overnight, mobile food vendors, duration of temporary events. That's if I'm loosely kind of grouping the type of uses that have these standards, community facility type of uses, community assembly, community gardens, farmers markets, and then some residential related uses relating to animal keeping as an example, home occupations, live work units. So there's a number of uses, and here's the list of all of the uses that have specific standards in the draft ordinance, and we'll go through each one of them individually. So that's an overview of the topics that you'll be going through tonight. Next steps, we do have another community workshop or public planning commission workshop next Monday on the 21st, which we'll be continuing with part four and planning to go into part five. And then that concludes my presentation.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I just have a kind of a housekeeping general thought that I want to pass for discussion. When I think of a zoning ordinance, I think of land use zones and how they relate to each other, residential, commercial, industrial, and how they relate and how they all get along. Section 17.41 is dealing with signs. And I'm just going to throw it out there as a suggestion that we either table it or we delete it, from the standpoint that I know the DRB spent a lot of time, as did members of the public, coming up with a sign ordinance that has been in use and has had practical application and success. And then we have a staff proposal associated directly with our zoning ordinance that needs to take into account some general plan compatibility issues and this and that. I think if you remove the sign ordinance completely from the zoning ordinance, it gives you a document that is a little bit more flexible and could be amended more easily than if it's directly tied to the zoning ordinance. Similar to parking standards, as automobile technology changes, do we have to get in and revise our zoning ordinance concerning radiuses and all that stuff, or should we have a separate parking guideline like other jurisdictions do? So I just want to throw that out there. It would be, you know, I'm sure some people are here to talk about signs, and I would love to hear from them, but I just throw that out there for the sake of discussion. Should we be doing it?
All right, let's see if there, any other commissioners wanted to weigh in on that subject, as long as we've opened this discussion. Any other comments? Commissioner
Chair, one thought here. When I was working at the city of Santa Barbara, the Planning Commission never worked on signs at all. So it was always the ABR. Okay. Thanks.
Commissioner Maynard, did you have a comment?
I guess I wanted to open it up to staff to say if you could give us some more background around why you chose to incorporate it in the zoning ordinance.
I'll get to staff.
Left. Okay.
I'm going to commissioners first, and then I'll come back. Absolutely, we want to hear what staff may have to say.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure exactly where we would put it if it wasn't in the zoning ordinance. Mm-hmm. I mean, a standalone is fine, you know, as mm-hmm. far as I'm concerned, as long as we have basically a sign ordinance, but we have a non-conforming use ordinance also, and it's in the zoning code. So things that you may not otherwise think would be there are there. Thank you.
All right. So if I can pitch this back to our director, correct me if I'm wrong, do we have a working sign ordinance in the city? And then go ahead and take up the rest of this discussion. Anything you'd like to comment?
Well, this is actually quite a surprise to hear this, and it's actually not at the part of the ordinance where we would normally be talking about it. The purpose of this ordinance is to provide the public with basic restrictions and guidelines. Signs are, in a lot of cities, are normally included in an ordinance. Some cities choose to keep it as a separate document. I find, in my experience, that it works better for the public to have everything related to development in one document. And even if we take it, it doesn't change the review, but it establishes the base requirements for what the city expects. And that goes for parking, it goes for signs, it goes for uses, it goes for land use. There are things in here, if we start picking and choosing, we're going to end up with several different documents that could end up competing and maybe not be consistent with one another. And that was one of the main impetuses to have the signs in here. We do have restrictions now. It doesn't stop anything from going to DRB for consideration. But I do think that guidance is very important. I'm sort of on the spot right now, so I would be much more eloquent if I was prepared. But I don't believe that separating it will actually benefit anyone at this point.
And Mr. Chair, I just want to offer an apology to staff because this was an epiphany I had driving over here. So really, it surprised me as well, all right? So it's not something I've been scheming on, so.
Ms. Wells, did you have anything to add to that discussion? Well, we certainly won't omit the page turn through that, and you know, your comment will be what it is if you want to reiterate that at that time for, you know, discussion. And obviously, the council would have the ultimate opportunity to deal with that. Okay. Commissioner Maynard.
So I also, as part of Ex Parte Communications, I went through and I watched the video of the Design Review Board's discussion on this, and I thought it was actually very enlightening. One of the things that was discussed there was doing a comparison of the ordinance that was proposed by Design Review Board and what the staff have developed as well. And I think a lot of hard work's been gone into both documents. I guess one question would be, should we wait to see the comparison of those two?
We're actually before ready we to talk change? About it tonight. We're prepared for that.
Okay.
So.
All right. So we have...
I guess at what point will we hear about hear your comparison of that, or do we just do that as we do the page turn? Okay.
Okay, good. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to go to the public and give you all an opportunity to speak tonight. And just before we get into that, I just want to thank all of you who have sent in comments, written comments in advance, all of you who are here, again, making the additional effort coming here, and those out there who may have sent in comments. And obviously, I think the commission, and I know the staff, goes through those to be familiar with them so we understand what the concerns are with the community. So I'm going to call public speakers up. I'll call the first and the next behind. We're going to allow 3 minutes for each speaker. Should there be a need to run over, I will allow that based on my discretion. So our first speaker is Roy. Bonkin? Bonkin?
Donkin.
And followed by Cecilia Brown.
Good evening, members of the Planning Commission, city staff, consultant, and friends. I'm here, I'm the pastor of the Cambridge Drive Community Church, and we are concerned about what we see as being unrealistic restrictions on religious communities when under the section on community gatherings, they're restricted from 9 until 9. In many religious traditions, that would literally be impossible to do. For example, we have Easter coming up. If you have a Greek Orthodox church, you have an Easter sunrise service that must happen. Begins outside the sanctuary, actually, as the sun comes up, and then the doors burst open and everyone goes in as the sun comes up. But the service starts well before sunrise outside. Many traditions require churches to have a midnight mass on Christmas. We see our Muslim friends who are required to have times of prayer that go through the day at various times. Breakfasts, prayer meetings, youth group meetings, 12-step programs, many, many kinds of events that take place at churches that literally cannot happen in that time frame. So we're asking you to consider how that can be modified to allow churches to literally do the things that they're required by their faith to be doing. Thank you.
Thank you. Cecilia Brown, followed by Michael Issa.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, Commissioners. I'm here tonight to speak on the city's sign ordinance and the problems with it. The sign ordinance is changing what has been in place and worked well for the signage landscape across the city for more than several decades. There is a proposal to allow more signage for the commercial zone districts compared to now what exists. If you look around the city at the signage, it sure seems to me that the current ordinance has provided plenty of signage for commercial districts, particularly in Old Town. Why change this scheme that has worked for so long? The general plan has many visual resource policies dealing with signs, and several of them speak to the visual character being enhanced through the use of restrained and tasteful signage. And two policies speak specifically, one to about minimizing signs and the other about minimizing the use of signage. Also, one of the purposes of the sign ordinance is to limit commercial signage in order to protect the city's aesthetic environment from the visual clutter, associated with the proliferation of signs. So why is the ordinance proposing an increase in the commercial in signage in the commercial areas, which is then in conflict with these two documents? Another area of inconsistency with general plan policies is the allowance for electronic changeable copy signs in quasi-public land uses, many of which are now located in residential neighborhoods. In my neighborhood, the northeast part of the city, where Commissioner Daniels and Commissioner Onan and Commissioner Jenkins happen to live, there are 12 of these public quasi-land uses. Most of them are churches, one a daycare facility and a banquet center down the street from me. Today, the only signage in the neighborhoods is the traditionally lighted and static changeable copy signs at churches, which is fine. The change to electronic changeable copy signs will be much like, but only smaller, the visually distracting LED sign at Earl Warren Showgrounds, blinking, flashing, shimmering, glittering, rotating, oscillating, and changing copy every few seconds. This will have a dramatic effect on the neighborhoods. No other sign in any other district in the city is allowed these characteristics. So why should these signs in these neighborhoods have these characteristics? These signs are in conflict with general plan policies about neighborhood identity and character and preserving and strengthening those qualities. Allowing these kinds of signs located in the neighborhoods will also conflict with Chapter 17.11 of the Zoning Code about the purposes of quasi-public land uses as contributing to the sense of place and quality of life in the residential neighborhood. No, they won't. Electronic changeable copy signs should not be allowed in any land use in residential zone districts. I have submitted a document to the city for their draft SCR where I pointed out the inconsistencies with electronic changeable copy signs with seven of the city's general plan visual resource and land use policies, and I appreciate having a few more minutes, Mr. Chair.
Please go on.
Thank you. There are other problems with regulations or lack of regulations in the sign ordinance regarding these signs about controlling brightness for the day and during the night, for glare, light trespass on adjacent properties, sign malfunction, hours of operation, and limiting how often the change can happen. The challenges with these signs are many. You need to have answers and the complete repertoire of standards to control where these signs are located and how they are regulated before putting these signs in the sign ordinance. Another issue with the sign ordinance is much like with the lighting guidelines that you saw. There needs to be a standalone design guideline section. If the Goleta Heritage and Architectural Design Guideline section has 3 pages alone for that community, and there's only less than 1 page for the entire rest of the city, seems to me we need to do a better job. In the information I sent you 2 communities that have a really bang-up section on design guidelines, and we need to have something like that for the rest of the city. The DRB has recommended its own sign ordinance, and I support what it is proposing. Eliminates all of the issues I address above. It has more complete information on definitions, a separate section on sign permit application process, a more complete section on material, construction, and maintenance standards. It keeps in place what has worked for so long, but also adds standards missing in the current ordinance about abating illegal signs, and has a much more robust section on getting rid of non-conforming signs. The bottom line is this. Just leave in place the standards for the current sign ordinance. You didn't recommend any drastic changes in development standards for the various zone districts, which seem to be working. So why would you be changing the proposed sign ordinance, which is working and consistent with several general plan policies? Stay with what you know and what works for the city. Thank you very much and appreciate the extra time.
Thank you. Okay, so Michael Issa followed by Kristen Miller.
Hi, Commissioners. Thank you for letting me talk. In addition to the previous comments I presented to the Commission regarding my concerns with the hurried pace of the public process relating to the ordinance project, to that end, I have some specific comments relating to the draft zoning code. This will begin with 17.39.020B. States that a change in occupancy is not considered a change in use unless the new occupant is a different use classification than the former occupant. Question this, what is a use classification? How will the city determine and confirm that a new occupant is a different use classification? Section 17.39.030A and C dictates that required off-street parking must not be used for storage or other non-parking related use, and that required parking must be accessible during all business hours. What are the consequences if I choose to park my car on the street? Can the city require me to park my car in my garage? What are the business hours that are, and how are they defined? Why should a residential garage be accessible during business hours? Section 17.39.030F says that one of the conditions for a garage conversion is the residence was built before 1960. How was the year 1960 determined? Is there a reference available to the public to see how the city determined that residences built before 1960 are somehow eligible for garage conversions? Section 17.39070 says that a parking in lieu fee will be calculated and set forth in a resolution of the City Council. How are these fees calculated, and when will the resolution go to council? If I can have a few more minutes. Section 17.42.030B states that medical marijuana uses is a prohibited accessory use. So recently the city passed a cultivation ordinance allowing anyone to cultivate regardless of what zone they're in. The city also passed a marijuana delivery ordinance that allows anyone to set up a delivery service in their home or in any zone. This seems as the proposed ordinance is in conflict with the recently passed resolution. Section 17.42.180D lists prohibited uses for home occupation, i.e. medical marijuana dispensaries or commercial cultivation or medical marijuana infusion. How are dispensaries, commercial cultivation, and medical...
Please.
Thank you. By the city's new ordinance not included in this list of prohibited medical marijuana uses. Question is, if marijuana delivery service is home-based, what is currently allowed? Would it not be allowed under the new zoning ordinance? And the last section I have a comment on is 17.42.230. It says that medical marijuana uses must be located, developed, and operated in compliance with the following standards, where allowed by Part 2 base zoning districts. Which base zoning district allows for marijuana uses? How does this square with the city's new marijuana cultivation ordinance, which doesn't limit cultivation of marijuana to a certain zone so long as they meet the certain restrictions? So as you can see, there are many unanswered questions, internal inconsistencies, and undefined terms in part four of this draft zoning ordinance. Once again, I urge the commission to take the time to thoroughly cover and correct this flawed document. Thank you.
Thank you. Kristen Miller, followed by Faramina Murray.
Good evening, Chair Onan and members of the Planning Commission. I'm Kristen Miller, President and CEO of the Goleta Valley Chamber of Commerce, representing 450 members and 30,000 jobs in the Goleta Valley. The Goleta Chamber is studying the draft zoning ordinance and is pleased to provide comments regarding that process, and we submitted a letter with comments regarding the DSEIR as well. I won't repeat that here, but I do want to hit the high points of the Chamber's analysis so far. I think you may know we have set up a zoning ordinance task force, business members, but also professional planners, engineers, architects, and more. And we are endeavoring to go through each module, as you are, and working to apply the draft to what we experience in the real world. We are not here to be overly critical. In fact, we're very supportive of the city's work on this, and much of what we've read so far is very good. We do, however, have questions and comments that we'll submit both in writing and in our stakeholder meeting that is scheduled. I'd like to just note a couple of things from our comments from the recent letter, which is that we're very pleased to see the effort for streamlining certain aspects of the permitting process with the addition of a zoning administrator. The city has made progressive, modern, and best practices a goal when it comes to efficiently addressing permits and processing. A zoning administrator who can make ministerial decisions on existing approved policy is a proven method for more efficient government. We are concerned that in the city's effort to match the new zoning ordinance with the approved general plan, that language choices be made that do not change the intensity of the general plan policy. For instance, some places the new code contains absolutes. Sometimes a condition may be considered versus must be considered. We believe a policy with appropriate flexibility in the language, should, produces a better outcome for all stakeholders versus a policy of absolutes, shall. We also appreciate the city's dedication to this process and the balance of community outreach efforts and to move efficiently to get this completed. We have long been advocates for government processes to move more quickly. However, in this case, we recognize the great pressure to analyze a huge amount of data in a short period of time. We are attempting to do just that as you are, but ask that if we get to the end of April or May and determine that more time is needed, that the city consider flexibility in the timeline. Thank you for hearing my comments.
Thank you very much. Faramina Murray. Followed by Ellen Bilstein.
Good evening, Chair Onan and members of the Commission. Thank you for this opportunity to speak. I am speaking about the sign ordinance, and I echo everything that Cecilia Brown said. I read some of those letters, and I hope you all would follow through. So the sign ordinance as proposed to allow the use of electronic changeable copy signs in the city of Goleta must be stopped from further consideration. This type of electronic signage is incompatible with the character of the city, its agricultural, architectural, and historical development over the last 160 years. Importing the idea of electronic changeable copy signs that are mostly found in big cities like Hong Kong, Las Vegas, or Times Square in New York to our suburban semi-rural good land is a violation of the vision of a peaceful, small-town atmosphere, as stated in the guiding principles and goals of the General Plan, Section 2.2. The new sign ordinance programs should be grounded in the city's own current guidelines, such as the design guidelines of Goleta Old Town Heritage District. These signage guidelines were created by the community to enhance the charm of the streetscape and the pedestrian experience. Since 2001, the Design Review Board has been using these guidelines in reviewing projects in Old Town and as guiding template for other projects in the city. So I say we because it's my husband and myself when I submitted the letter to you. We strongly urge you to remove entirely the allowance of electronic changeable copy signs in the new signage ordinance and to adopt suggestions put forward by the Design Review Board, including the provisions for enforcement of standards. And lastly, for staff, we request that you take seriously and follow through on all the suggestions from Cecilia Brown. We are fortunate to have such an experienced and dedicated citizen advocate for Goleta. We trust that in your review of the proposed signed ordinance, you will protect the precious visual, environment, and small-town character of Goleta. The qualities of life that are defined in the general plan will be destroyed forever by allowing electronic, changeable copy signs in our community. We urge you to deny this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. Ellen Bildston, followed by Ben Werner. Werner? Not sure of the correct pronunciation, Ben.
Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for hearing all of the comments that everyone out here has to make. Mine pertain to very much related to our next speaker, Ben Werner, who is a representative of the SLRI efforts that were strongly encouraged to be included in this zoning ordinance modification. And I just wanted to add a voice to encouraging that the policies of the SLRI be strongly adopted by this zoning update. And as an architect here in town, also to comment on my own experiences working with other areas in Santa Barbara, specifically in the city, where a similar effort has been underway to consider variations on zoning on a sort of experimental basis. And that's led to a lot of affordable workforce housing being built in the city under the guise of the AUD, the average unit size density. I think that's a really good example of the type of outcome that could result from adopting the SLRI principles here in the city of Goleta. And I think it's a very good example to draw some inspiration from. And there are so many other aspects of the SLRI related to energy efficiency and conservation of water and energy resources that I think the flexibility that could be built into the Goleta zoning code would be very beneficial and demonstrative to other areas here in Santa Barbara that would be a great example for others to draw inspiration from. So thank you for hearing our comments.
Ms. Bildston, the acronym you used stands for SLRI?
Sustainable Living Research Initiative. Oh. Sorry, I should have said that at the beginning.
You should have recognized it. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Werner, followed by Ginger Anderson.
Thank you, Chair and Commissioners. A couple of years ago, when your new zoning ordinance efforts began, myself and several others came before your consultant at the time and shared our vision for the Sustainable Living Research Initiative. And we're very pleased that there's language to that in the current draft. However, it's quite frankly really more a notional language. And wouldn't really achieve the effects that we'd like to, primarily just because at the time we didn't have a well-thought-through draft to submit to the consultant, and staff until now hasn't really had the time to really flesh that out. Fortunately, as the previous speaker, Helen, mentioned, we have been working with the city of Santa Barbara over the last year and have had the opportunity to really figure out a lot of the nuts and bolts that need to be in place for the SLRI to work, specifically pertaining to the kinds of flexibility in zoning that you would need to really make meaningful experiments in more progressive zoning on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the kind of enforcement and monitoring and accountability that you need to create a container to do that those experiments. So my request, in short, is to support staff, as I believe that they're interested in and willing to begin with the work we've been doing recently with the city of Santa Barbara, and provide any necessary modifications to make it appropriate for Goleta. But I think we've done a fair amount of work already, and hopefully it wouldn't require an inordinate effort and time from staff to make the SLRI a functional zoning program for Goleta. You did receive some information from me a week or two ago, I believe, that provides some pretty specific examples of the kinds of performance-based zoning that could happen, which reminds me, there's another part to my request, which is currently the SLRI is just pertaining to agriculture. As per the examples you've seen from me, there's some great potential in other zones, well, pretty much in any zone in the city. So hopefully, as we're doing with Santa Barbara, the SLRI will pertain to any zone that an applicant would wish to apply under. So thanks for your time and for your anticipated support of staff to update that section. Thank you.
Thank you. Ginger Anderson, followed by Meg West.
Hi, good evening, commissioners, staff. My name is Ginger Anderson. I'm with Stantec. I'm part of the Chamber's task force combing through this code and providing copious notes and comments. I want to applaud staff's efforts so far. I went through the whole SEIR and didn't actually come up with too much of concern. And I found a lot of good stuff in looking at the sections for tonight. I look forward to getting into the weeds on certain sections with staff later this week. A bunch of planner nerds together talking about planning. My comments for oil and gas at this time are limited to 17.38040K, and it defines a requirement to provide an unconditional will serve letter for water. And my comment to that is to provide the Goleta Water District's process chart and make sure that the timing of that requirement matches something that's doable for the community or an applicant. Parking, again, there's a lot of good stuff in there, and I look forward to doing some exercises to see what the particulars would do in a site plan. And the alternative parking area design is a great section to have in there for flexibility. I was here last time with a lot of RV parking comments. There was a couple other sections that I think should be looked at. When you look at that section, they kind of cross-apply. 1739070A3. 1742.180B11 and 12. In the hazardous materials section, there's a requirement to find the source and make them pay to clean it up before you can have a development. I think that's might be impossible in some cases that staff consider allowing like a mediation plan instead as a condition of approval rather than that hard requirement. A couple of sections have the word objectionable, and that's subjective, I think. You know, there's obvious places where that's objectionable to everybody, but that's kind of verbiage that may give staff a little bit of uncertainty later. Vibration, one of my comments was that in several places in the code, it talks about measuring at the property lines, and I'm wondering if we can talk or consider scenarios where one owner owns multiple lots, multiple legal parcels, they all work together. We're measuring at the furthest one or the most outer rather than the parcel it's on. It's a little ambiguous. For standards for specific uses, I think that whole section needs to define primary uses versus accessory uses. For instance, a community garden, is that a primary use? And the question leads to, if we have a community garden and we want to put in a bathroom or a shed. Now you've got a garden, no structures, and you want to add an accessory structure to that. So I think we should do some definitions there. The large family daycare, I want to talk with staff a little bit more about that because providing for childcare, can I have another minute?
Please.
Providing for childcare is such a huge ordeal for a lot of people and a great expense. So I'm hoping it looks like it's trying to protect those uses. I just want to make sure that is the case. Second units, typically, the size of a second unit is based on the lot size, not the size of the primary house. So if you have an older, smaller structure and you want to put a second unit, I think tying it to the size of the first may not be the best way to go in all cases. And then I'll finish off on this, the temporary uses. There's some, I don't know if it's conflicting or if I was just really tired when I looked at that section, but there's a couple sections that seem that they might conflict. 17.42, 360, B7, 8, and 9 versus 17.42, 360, A4, basically defining construction trailers and construction offices and when those are allowed and what they need, because it kind of, they look like they kind of mix up a little bit. That's all I have, and I look forward to meeting with staff and going through more, but thank you very much, and I appreciate all the work that's gone into this. It's a lot of work. Thanks.
Thank you. Former Planning Commissioner Meg West, followed by Reverend Doug Miller.
Hi, everybody. Chair Onan and commissioners. I'm here today for two reasons. One is to support Cecilia's Brown's letter objecting to blinky signs. I, too, do not want blinky signs in residential districts. Secondly, I'm here to voice my support for the Sustainable Living Research Initiative, which is the SLRI. I got interested in that work years ago because, as some of you know, I'm a landscape architect and I specialize in sustainable design. And some of the things that we wanted to design into projects were prohibited by zoning. One example would be rain tanks and setbacks, which I hope the staff is thinking about including by right in this new zoning code, but that was something that was previously not allowed that I felt should be allowed. Another thing that I think could be a good use of setbacks would be covered bicycle parking. And these are all things, so in my mind, there are many examples of site-specific uses that need some flexibility in order to further the best practices for sustainable living. And the SLRI basically provides a framework where the Planning Commission and the City Council still have discretion over the project. They still can look at the site and decide what is right for that site, and there's still a process for public input that is no different from the process we already have. It just allows for unforeseen things to potentially become built and part of our community. We might not know now where we have to go in the future to create the built environment we want to leave to the next generation. So it was interesting. I was at the third district supervisor debate the other day, and one of the candidates made an interesting statement. He said, "Goleta has been the victim of its own success." And I thought, what does he mean by that? What does he mean by that? And I think what he meant by that was we've grown so much so quickly and created a lot of infrastructure for this city that has brought with it some consequences that some of the residents don't like. Increased traffic congestions, one, more parking areas, more development. So we know we have to grow. We know that we have to provide more housing in the future. Is it possible to decouple the need for more housing from these undesirable effects of development? I believe that's what the SLRI can do, and that's why I have put my time into really thinking about the details with a group of architects and with Ben. It's something that has we hope will be embraced by the city of Santa Barbara, and we hope will be embraced by all zones for the city of Goleta. And if I could have just a few more seconds, I wanted to talk about ag for a moment. So we have a lot of high-tech innovation here in Goleta, and we hear a lot about incubating this. What about agricultural innovation? We know that the farmers here are having a lot of trouble now with the water situation, with the high price of land. It's difficult to get farm workers and things like that. We want to keep that ag in Goleta, and one of the illustrations that you'll see in the book that we put together that really illustrates a residential idea for this, an agricultural idea for this. Okay, I will pause here. Anyway, so when I hope you get a chance to take a look at that book, and I think that on page 5 and 6 of that book, we show how this could be applied to an agricultural parcel in Goleta, I think with really good effect, because it would allow farmers to have more flexibility in the uses of their land while maintaining the agricultural character of the land in order to bring more investment innovation to their practice. And it's something I hope that would help Goleta farmers stick around for the long term. Thank you.
Ms. West, just a quick question. Yes. The book you referred to?
It is a... an example of what the SLRI would do for three separate zones with a graphic showing the current condition of the zoning and then what would be potentially permitted with the SLRI as a part of our zoning code. So it was sort of a way to, these are imagined properties, they're not real places, but they kind of, we feel represent accurately what might happen if Goleta chose to include the SLRI. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to answer them. But we hope the book can help because it's complicated.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Reverend Doug Miller, followed by Steve Fort.
Chairperson, commissioners, I represent the Greater Santa Barbara Clergy Association. And we're very concerned about the ordinance that limits sacrosanct worship from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. We feel that this is an egregious interference with religious worship. As you heard before, there are many, many congregations that have Easter sunrise services, that have midnight masses, that have prayer vigils all night, that have Christmas Eve services, that have early morning masses and Bible studies. And we think that this is a violation of the Constitution where it says that, government, quote, shall enact no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion unless there's a compelling reason or an interest of the highest order, is the way one judge put it. And we cannot see any high interest that there is in limiting the times of worship and worship experiences. In fact, one justice says that even if the law is rational and valid and legitimate and important, it cannot impinge upon a constitutional right. And we can't see how even any restrictions of time on religious worship, even if it's rational, that it should not impinge upon this very protected right. We still don't understand why it's in there. About the only thing we can understand is maybe noise, but you already have an ordinance for that, and if a congregation is too noisy, they should be cited for that. I try to Google any municipalities that have time limits on worship. I couldn't find any. Maybe there are some. I know that there are some dictatorships, some communist countries that try to regulate worship. But I cannot find a place in America or a city in America where that is done. The church is sacred space. Its worship is sacred. And it's our view that government should not interfere or try to regulate that worship by conditional use permits or any other kinds of permits. And I'm kind of surprised that this should come up during a time when the question of religious liberty is such an issue today. So we hope you'll reconsider that and eliminate that onerous restriction upon our ability to worship. Thank you.
Thank you. Steve Fort, followed by Bill Shelor.
Good evening, Chair Owen and members of the commission. Thank you. My name is Steve Fort. I'm with Suzanne Ellich Planning and Permitting. And like I said when I was here before, we're tracking the city's effort, and we're doing some speaking at the hearings and also submitting written comments as we go along. And we are also supportive of the Goleta Chamber's efforts as well. To start with the oil and gas section, we are not experts in the oil and gas industry. But I did want to point out, and I think the Chamber will also in their written comments, that there's a finding in there in the oil and gas facility abandonment section that seems like it could be onerous related to streets and highways need to be adequate for a gas or oil facility to be abandoned. And we just think you ought to take a look at that and make sure you're not precluding abandonment when appropriate. In terms of the parking regs for single-use developments, I believe I'm correct when it's indicating that all single-family residential parking is to be placed in a garage. We just ask whether this is appropriate for all zone districts, all lot sizes throughout the city, and consider some flexibility for carports or and/or constrained lots. Then I noticed for assisted living facilities, there's a requirement for one space per guest room which could potentially be excessive considering that some residents of those facilities may not be able to drive or have a desire to drive. With regard to the parking regs and the landscaping requirements, they are fairly complex and detailed. We would suggest that consult with a landscape architect and someone experienced with designing parking lots to test and vet those requirements and make sure that they're reasonable. These can be a major factor into whether a project pencils out or not, and we just want to make sure they're reasonable and flexibility is provided where warranted. Just a couple comments to wrap up related to housing. This section on farm worker housing, the intro paragraph is a little confusing. I'm not sure if it applies to structures with a residential land use designation or properties with a residential land use designation. And it goes on to require that an ag operator have a permit from HCD to operate. And based on my experience in permitting single ag employee dwellings, I'm not familiar with the fact that HCD would get involved with a single ag employee dwelling unit that an ag operator would want to propose. With regard to residential care facilities, we just ask that you study that requirement for 300 feet of separation between facilities. What is the potential impact or concern that's being addressed there? And then going to second dwelling units, will they be allowed on legal non-conforming lots or lots with non-conforming structures? And I offer those under the feeling that we need as much affordable type of housing here on the South Coast as possible, and hopefully we can be as flexible as we can on those housing regs. Thank you.
Thank you. Bill Sheeler.
Good evening, Chair Onen and Planning Commissioners. My name is Bill Sheeler. I want to call attention to the Sustainable Living Research Initiative, SLRI, and its potential applicability and importance in sustaining and enhancing agriculture in Goleta. I'm now going to quote from Goleta's General Plan, Policy LU7 regarding agriculture. Objective, to preserve existing agricultural lands and reserve vacant lands suitable for agriculture to maintain the option of future agricultural uses, including local production of food commodities. The intent of this designation is to preserve lands used for agriculture, as well as lands with characteristics that make them suitable for agriculture, to meet the needs of present and future generations. Goleta residents reaffirmed their support of local agriculture and the general plan when they passed Measure G 2012, the Goleta Agricultural Protection Initiative, with a 72% voter approval. Reasonable goals and outcomes from the SLRI could include increasing local food security, supporting small businesses, i.e. farmers, creating jobs, providing on-site affordable workforce housing, reduction of greenhouse gas associated with the transportation of agricultural products, opportunities for educational outreach with local school districts and research with the Brent School at UC Santa Barbara, and potential for revenue generation through ecotourism. A zoning code that supports sustainable living research sites has the potential to protect and enhance agricultural opportunities in Goleta, while providing the regulatory flexibility to explore multiple sources of revenue generation. Thank you for your consideration of the Sustainable Living Research Initiative, as it can be a model for community collaboration on multiple levels.
Thank you, Mr. Sheeler. So that's my last speaker slip. Staff, do you want to comment on anything that was said here before we get back to the commission?
Yeah, I think there are a few things that we've been discussing about clarifying. Just a couple things for me, and then Martha will probably talk about some things. But medical marijuana, we released the zoning ordinance back in November, and since then things have changed, and we've adopted new regulations. So that's just inherent with the review process when you release a public review draft and things change since then. So there'll be some other things where there'll be rule changes since as we're reviewing this, that we'll have to stay on top of, and that's one of them. The SLRI, I just wanted to make sure that you are aware that we've been working closely with the team and the public for a couple years now, at least, about the concept, and it's been maturing. Even as of today, you know, they sent us some additional information that is really helpful. So it may be that the timing of it isn't perfect right here because we're still working on it, at least for tonight. But it is, you know, we have invested a lot of time because it's obviously a pretty noteworthy, has noteworthy objectives. For the oil and gas, which is the first subject when we get to it tonight, for you to do a page turn on, I just wanted to emphasize that we imported generally the existing regulations because we're just trying to hold that section still while we're, you know, we only have a couple of these facilities in the city, and we're trying to work through some issues with the landowners and with the state. So we're trying to keep this still while we're sorting things out with the state in general. And then we, you know, there's a lot of other input and tonight that we've received in writing and from the public and said very well, and we've been taking notes and talking, but wanted to make sure like that it's clear this is a workshop and it's a public review draft, and you know, we didn't necessarily get everything right. We've worked hard on it, and every time we've produced another version of it, we're getting closer and closer and closer. So we're, you know, tightening up things like community assembly, for example, and just making it better and better and better as we go. So that's what we intend to do, and I know that's what you intend to do tonight. And I think Martha has some clarifications.
Just to answer a couple of the questions, one of them, what was a use classification? And the use classifications are included in Chapter 1770 of your ordinance. They're all defined there. The question about required parking and needing to be available during business hours, well, and that's to provide, just to make it clear that it has to be available for the intended, you know, purpose. If a restaurant is required to provide parking, that parking should be available while the restaurant is open. Street parking is whether somebody can park in the street. That's regulated separately in the municipal code, and I believe it's 72 hours is the time limit on that. The in-lieu fee for parking, what's established in here is the enabling ordinance. If the city were to adopt an in-lieu fee program study for parking, and that would be, that fee would be established through future study and through council decision. And then the 1960 date for garages, for the garage conversion, it's not really a magic date with that. It's just generally when, was it the first kind of bulk of single family development happened, and typically had smaller garages than what kind of you would see today with development. So there's no, it's not a magic date, really, just kind of rule of thumb taken for that.
All right, thank you.
I'd just like Director. To add that, as Ann mentioned, we are continuing to meet with interested members of the public. We did have a meeting over the community assembly hour restrictions with a large contingent of our interfaith community in Goleta, Isla Vista, and Santa Barbara that Doug was at. So including the meetings with Ben Warner, and we're continuing to meet with any interested party who would like to talk about their specific issue in the zoning ordinance.
Good. Thank you. Okay. So, Commission, before we get into our page turning, anyone need a break? Good. Okay, so we won't be here much past 10.
Could I ask a question of staff?
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. With regards to the community facilities and meeting hours, do those have to include other uses besides religious uses?
Can we talk about that when we get to that point?
Okay.
Because that, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of info behind that that encompasses that question.
Well, I hope we will then. Thank you.
Okay. Unless there's a suggested change of procedure, my intention is to do what we've been doing at the last couple meetings, where we're going page by page, going commissioner to commissioner, allowing everyone to make their comments. not necessarily including a direct response from staff. That's we're trying to make sure the comments are recorded, not necessarily go into the discussion item of all those, unless there's a general misunderstanding that may need clarification. But anybody see a change in that procedure? Nope. Okay. So here we go. I believe we are starting on page IV 109, oil and gas facilities. Are we right there? So, Commissioner Maynard, you get first.
Okay, I'll just ask one general question about the purpose for quick clarification. Is that this does not, it sounds like this is only for existing, some expansion of existing uses and abandonment, current operations. It looks like there's nothing about new drilling in here. Is that correct? So there's, if it was a new drilling project, it wouldn't be covered by this?
Interesting.
That's correct. That's generally correct. That we do have a well drilling section in our municipal code, so that's already been adopted in our muni code.
Okay. Thank you. That helps with the clarification, because I noticed some of the changes in your table, which I've utilized this time, includes some of the drilling restrictions were taken out of the, were not carried from the general code to the zoning code, and that's because this doesn't address drilling. Okay. Thank you for that clarification.
Okay. Anything on that page? No. Commissioner Fuller?
No.
Commissioner Jenkins?
No.
Commissioner Daniels?
No, sir.
All right. Commissioner Daniels, you're up on the next page. 110. Anything there? Just on 110.
It says 152 for me. 1740, 50 air quality.
Heat. Nope. Let's see.
1738. 040.
Oh, you're in performance standards. So we're all the way back to
oil and gas.
I'm not far enough. Here we are, right here.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
All right, so we're on page 110. Anything there, Mr. Daniels?
Chair, can you get back to me, please?
Yes. Commissioner Jenkins.
I don't have anything on that one, nor 111.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller, 110 or 111.
Okay.
Commissioner Jenkins included it.
So since it was brought up, I just thought I'd get some clarification, if that's all right, from the
staff. Go ahead.
On K, on 111, is that standard, the unconditional can and will serve letter? Are those typically given after the project's been approved as far as can, you know, unconditional?
I think we had that from public comment.
We did.
To make sure that we're in line with the Goleta Water District's policy, if you will.
Right, yeah. Okay, so just make, yeah, noted.
Good. Commissioner Maynard.
Sure. So at the top of page 110, where we're looking at permit requirements and required findings, I know in the general plan, safety element 8.6 required a qualitative risk assessment. So I wondered if that would be appropriate here. Also, if we could put in language that the proposed facility is not in a marine ESHA. I know we have restrictions on new facilities and marine ESHAs, or I guess that gets to the new facility issue, so maybe not. And I'm also, as we're saying that there are no feasible alternative locations, would a no project alternative also be considered as an alternative? I know in CEQA sometimes that there's a no project is an alternative, so I'd like that to be potential there. For the height limit, I know generally in this zone we would look at 35 feet, so I wanted to understand a little bit more why 45 feet was chosen here. I'd like to see 35 if we could. On page 111, we have some language around water resources and grading. I'm wondering if we could also put in language about ensuring protection of groundwater resources as well, especially as with some of the new fracking and types of drillings. I always worry about that. On the spill section, which is N on page 111, it talks about effective containment and cleanup, and given all the different situations, spills that we've had nationally, I wonder if we need a little bit more definition of effective, and if we could be more specific about what's required for effective. I'd like to see that infrastructure is regularly monitored. Maybe even if we could put in language about what if, like, when Goleta staff time has to put in, Goleta staff have to put in time cleanup, does the industry have any responsibility to pay fees or reimburse the staff for their time on a spill situation? I'm wondering if we could require equipment for cleanups to actually be held on site so that it could be cleaned up more quickly. Getting a little bit more specific about the spills and how we ensure that those could be cleaned up quickly. That's all that I've got on 111.
Okay. I have nothing on 110. On 111, I'll echo the comment I think that was made from the public, public about offensive odors. Mm-hmm. And then a little later in that same paragraph, F, that are detectable outside the facility boundary, which obviously what kind of detection that covers any kind of detection, is that appropriate language there? Mr. Daniels, we're back to you on page 110 and 111.
Well, which is the 111 last sentence. I'm wondering if you've touched base with Fish and Wildlife for the significant impacts to surface water due to short-term sedimentation of stream must be mitigated to the maximum extent feasible through adequate erosion and sediment control. That looks like Fish and Wildlife needs to be in charge there.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else on those pages?
No. Thank you.
Mr. Commissioner Jenkins, let's go to 112, and feel free to expand into 113.
I have nothing, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Nothing on 112, 113, Mr. Fuller?
I'm good.
Commissioner Maynard?
I have a few. The required setback of 25 feet seems very short to me, but then I also note your staff's comment earlier about trying to stay consistent right now, but I'll just note that that seems like a very short distance to me. Also, for 113, which is 1738050B2E, there's the language that says undue hardship, and I just wonder that that's too vague and easy for interpretation. I'd rather like to better understand what an undue hardship would be there.
All right. Commissioner Daniels, 112 and 113. Any comments there? Anything, Mr. Daniels?
I think I had an issue with this is on 113 5B performance securities. I would think that the securities would be taken by the building department. But that's my thought. I don't know. You know, that's what they usually do.
Okay.
I don't know if this. This particular jurisdiction does that, but it caught my eye. Thank you.
Okay. So, Mr. Daniels, can you go to page 114 and 115 if you have any comments on either one of those two pages? page.
At 15 also?
Yes, please. Come back to you if you need a little more time.
If you can come back to me on 115, that would be great.
I will.
Thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins, 114, 115.
I'm good.
Commissioner Fuller?
I'll reserve for the moment.
All right. Commissioner Maynard?
On page 114.7, spills. I'd like this to also echo some of my comments before that I think we're not specific enough about spill measures. So it says other measures deemed necessary. I'd like that more spelled out. Also on number 9 on page 114, I know safety element 8.14 got a little bit more into the burial depth and also assessing every requirement for assessing every 5 years. So I'd like staff to compare number 9 on this page to safety element 8.14. I do not have any comments on 115.
Thank you. Mr. Daniels, back to you on 115. Anything that you found there?
In number C4, I had a question there. When a new pipeline route is proposed, it's environmentally preferable to feasibly alternative routes. So there's something that doesn't work on that sentence at all.
Okay. Bless.
Help me out. Do you see nothing there? It doesn't make any sense, does it?
Let's leave that. Your comment will be recorded, and we'll let staff work on that.
Okay. Thanks.
Commissioner Jenkins, let's go to page 116 and 117.
Nothing, Mr. Chair.
Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good.
Commissioner Maynard?
No comments on 16 or 17.
So, Commissioner Daniels, we're back to 16, 116 and 117. Anything there?
Negative. Thank you.
Right. So do you want to take 118 and 119 right away? Anything that you had there? And Commissioner Maynard, I'm going to jump to you as soon as Commissioner Daniels is done.
F1 talks about mitigation to a less than significant level. I know that from CEQA, but I don't know that it's really talking about CEQA right here, unless it's shown that the impacts cannot be feasibly mitigated. And that's not defined as Commissioner Maynard has said. Mitigation to the maximum extent feasible at the end.
Okay.
Again, F1, I had issues with it.
Anything else on 118 or 119?
18, 19. Time limit for decommissioning. You get what I get. It's 4 years total, and I'm just thinking. Really, is that enough for decommissioning? 4 years? I don't know.
Okay.
Is it?
Anything else on that page?
No, thank you.
Commissioner Maynard.
On page 118, F
two, there was a public comment about streets and highways here. And I have to echo that a little bit. I wouldn't want you to have to build a street to decommission a non-conforming use. So I'd want to play with this language a little bit to address the concern, the reasoning behind this, because I think there's a good thought behind this. But I'd want to make it not restrictive so that you don't have to build a street to take something out. So I would agree with that. On G, conditions required for decommissioning and reclamation, I'd like a little bit more language about soil and water quality, in particular if the soils become contaminated because of the project. I'd like soil testing and then that and some remediation for that. And maybe that's already an F, but I didn't see it clearly, so I wanted to ask for that.
Commissioner Fuller, we're on 118, 119.
Right. I just, the only comment is that three does ensure monitoring for compliance on the environment, but it doesn't specifically say soils and waters, which would be a good thing to do. Yeah, that's all.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins, did you have a shot at these pages?
I did, but I just wanted to also echo what Commissioner Maynard said about the streets and highways. It seems a plausible concern.
Okay. All right, so Commissioner Maynard, we're going to come back to you on 120.
I have nothing on 120, but I do have one comment on 121.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. On 121, 1738070C1, the decision on application to defer abandonment and basis for denial. What if it's a non-conforming use? Can we deny an extension of that project? That would be my only request.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller.
I'm good.
All right. Commissioner Jenkins?
Nothing.
Commissioner Daniels?
Top of the page, the first paragraph before deferrals. Letter must be completed. Letter must certify completion of all required work exempt for remediation or of contamination, which is certified by other agencies. Who are you talking about?
So you think agencies should be specified?
Yes, please.
Thank you. Anything else on those pages, Mr. Daniels?
On C1, on the bottom of the page, basis of denial, one of the performance standards here is within a reasonable time period, or period of time. We got to get specific with these, because I'm looking at it as an enforcement thing, and this, there's a lot of this kind of talk in here, and I don't like it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we're going to go to page 122, and we'll finish this section, and then we'll go into parking and loading. So, Commissioner Jenkins, any comments on 122?
Nothing.
Commissioner Fuller?
Nope.
No. Commissioner Maynard?
No.
Commissioner Daniels, page 122, final page on the oil and gas. Anything there?
I'm at 122 right now.
Yeah.
No, sir.
All right. How about you taking the first page in parking and loading, page 123. Any comments there?
No, sir.
Commissioner Jenkins.
Nothing on 123.
Okay, I'll just throw in the D item, the flexibility, calling out some flexibility. Obviously a very useful tool for us there. Mm-hmm. Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good.
Commissioner Maynard?
On 1739010B, I'd like to also add including reducing heat island effect as one of the specific environmental impacts we're trying to reduce. I think it gives some rationale to some of what's recommended later.
And that was spoken of in parking standards earlier in the zoning.
Yes, I did steal that idea from the design review board.
Thank you. So why don't you take page 124 and 125?
Okay. So on 124, okay, so 1739030A, there is some language that says no property owner can sublease, subrent, or otherwise encumber the off-street parking. But then it also in on the next page in E, it talks about unbundling parking. And I'm wondering if those are consistent. I see that this is about off-street. I'm not sure if E relates to off-street. But just a question about consistency between those two. And then for 1739030C, where it says required parking must be accessible during all business hours, I appreciated Ms. Miller's clarification earlier. Maybe we could say for commercial areas or commercial zones, that might clarify it a little bit more, because I think the public comment was about a residential use. So just to put that out there. Did you want 125?
Please.
Okay. Okay, so then for F, residential garage conversion, equivalent number of covered off-street parking spaces will be provided. Is there a reason why it's required to be covered? Does the front driveway count towards that parking or not? So those are my questions for clarification.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller, did you have anything on these two pages?
No.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins?
Yes, Mr. Chair. On page 124, under 1739030A, in the middle of that paragraph, it says no property owner can sublease, subrent, or otherwise encumber the off-street parking spaces required by this chapter. And I just made a note to myself, and these notes were made weeks ago, so I had a note to provide an exception for complementary uses within 500 feet of each other, as an example, community assembly and office. Similar to shared parking, which you have in Ordinance 1739050D and off-site 1739070C. And then on page 125, E1, I had a note to myself saying that first paragraph, E1, talking about all off-street spaces. I'm just asking to please reword that. It's a confusing run-on sentence. And then E2 and 3, paragraph 2 talks about spaces must be offered first, and then in number 3 it says must have equal opportunity, so offered first, then equal opportunity. I'm just curious if that's a conflict, if you catch my gist on that. I also had a note regarding residence was constructed before 1960, what the nexus is for that, and I think staff has answered that. And then equivalent number of covered off-street parking spaces will be provided on-site under, which is F2. And I just want to make a note stating that previously uncovered spaces were allowed, so it just seems like this is creating a lot of nonconformity. And I'm just not sure we want to create that much nonconformity in the city. And then on interior garage dimensions are no more, this is under garage conversion, the interior garage dimensions are no more than 10 feet wide by 30 feet deep. And I was a little confused by that dimension. Are you talking about tandem in that situation, which we currently don't have, but so I wonder if you can explain those dimensions 10 by 30 for me.
All right, we're gonna go to you, Director.
I just have a question for the commission on F1. I know there's been some talk about the 1960 date.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want a date? Let's step back and look at a bigger mm-hmm. picture. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, we're going to jump in and ask the tough questions when we hit them, just to get your opinions. Do you want to allow conversions in general? Do you want restrictions in place by year? Is that something that the commission is interested in? We do have some work to do about the how to replace the parking if there's a garage conversion. We'll have to look at some further language there. But I just wanted to float that because that'll be an issue that the council will take up, and we want to see your thoughts or hear your thoughts.
Well, Mr. Chair, I have a question for staff. If someone were to present a garage conversion proposal to the city today, how would it be handled?
Today?
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe, actually, we haven't received any in my tenure here. Probably because they just are discouraged in general.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, every case I'm aware of around the city, as you're driving around, you can tell the ones that have happened. It seems like they're just parking on their driveway.
Correct.
It seems like the ones that where it's a side entry garage and you've got the ability of parking beyond your front yard setback line, it seems like those ones make a little more sense. Mm-hmm. I don't know about that, the date.
Let me run it through the rest of the commission. Commissioner Maynard, the question is about garage conversion. So we're
can I ask for one clarification first, just really quickly? Residential garage conversion requires an actual renovation project, or if someone's just using it as a workshop, not a renovation, is that a conversion?
Like a conversion would be to an actual
full renovation.
Full renovation. Okay. The door is no longer usually the door is no longer usable, but okay. A full workshop. Those are kind of iffy because you can still park the car in the garage typically, even if you have a workshop.
Potentially. Okay. I would be open to not having a date and just keeping the second two, the other restrictions.
Commissioner Fuller?
If I may, two things. One to a previous item, but on this one, I don't see the reason to have a date. You know, just if they want a garage conversion, they come in, they meet the requirements, or they don't meet the requirements, mm-hmm. no matter when they were mm-hmm. built. I just want to comment that on E above, my hesitance there is that this may sound like a great idea now, but 30 years from now when people are trying to resell property, this could be a real nightmare situation. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just saying.
Okay. Commissioner Daniels, did you have any comment on that garage conversion question?
No, Chair. Thank you.
Okay. I'll just make a comment that for me, garage conversions is about where the alternative parking mm-hmm. right, can be accommodated. Mm-hmm. So that would be the standard. I think garage conversions where parking can be replaced on the property have a potential for allowability. Without that, it creates all these other problems throughout the neighborhood, on-street parking, that gets consumed and those kind of things. So that has been what I think is the test in that area. Mm-hmm. Mr. Daniels, I think we didn't get to you on page 124 and 125.
Okay, Chair, one quick question on, or answer on 125. F1, you're talking about 1960. It's not based on anything. I mean, the city's not that old. So, it's not based on anything, so I wouldn't want it. Okay, that's all.
Okay. I'll take us back to item on 124D. This is about stacked parking. Perhaps I'm not completely understanding of what the use of stacked parking, but the last line troubles me. With the zoning administrator, guarantee must be filed with the zoning administrator, ensuring that an attendant will always be present when the lot is in operation. So there are stacked parking uses that, in other words, they all come in and leave at the same time. Perhaps doesn't require an attendant to be on duty mm-hmm. the entire time. I think we need to look at that sentence. Otherwise, I have no comment on page 125. Takes us. Commissioner Maynard.
I think you just made a good point, and can I elaborate just a little bit, because you inspired a thought in me, which is that potentially stacked parking could also be based upon rush hour times. So if I think of like a restaurant, right, that might be open in the afternoon but not doing any stacked parking at that point, but the dinner rush where they're really packed is where you need stacked parking. So maybe some allowances for matching the use of stacked parking to the need of that might be another way to do that.
Okay. So I think as long as we have you at the mic, let's go to 126 and 127. Sure. And this is our list of tables here.
For the single unit dwelling, table 1739040A2, single unit dwelling, I think the two spaces is fine for a single unit dwelling. I'm not sure that I agree with this plus one space that's required. And I think that it shouldn't have to be within the garage if they do have driveway space in front of the garage. As I'm just driving around the neighborhoods here, it's very, very common for people to park in their driveway. It seems like that should be allowable for the two spaces. I also wanted to comment that it was a little odd that the mobile home parks required more guest parking than multiple unit dwellings. I wasn't quite sure why they would have more guests necessarily, so that was sort of an odd number there. And having 1.5 spaces for one bedroom seems a little excessive to me, but I'm in a generation that mostly buses. So I'll just note that seems a little bit extra for me. Are we doing 127 or are we waiting?
Yes, please.
Okay, 127. The colleges and trade schools, public or private, and hospitals, I thought it might make sense to add visitor parking.
That was a comment by the DRB.
Yep, and I thought it was a good comment, so I made it again.
Okay, Commissioner Fuller?
Chair, before we go on, do you mind if I clarify something?
I would love for you to clarify
Sorry to break you off there, Commissioner Fuller. Commissioner Maynard made a comment about mm-hmm. parking in garages. This mm-hmm. is, and we've had this come up a few times. Mm-hmm. So the requirement is to have the space count for your garages. It's not saying you can't park in your driveway.
Mm-hmm.
It's just saying you need to have your parking to meet your parking space requirements. You have to have this number of garages. So that is for the parking, but that it's not excluding parking in the driveway. If you wanted to exclude parking in the driveway, we would have to add that in.
Okay. Can I clarify? So I guess part of my thinking in this is it ends up going back to, for example, the garage conversion. So if there is a garage conversion, then that would require that they have the two space. So say their driveway can handle two parking spaces, then they've got to have two parking spaces plus two additional parking spaces. So it's four parking spaces for a single residence because they've done a garage conversion. That seems excessive to me. So maybe that's where I'm going with this.
And I think you're kind of hitting on something that we've been working on, where we've realized that there's some tweaks that need to be made to line these sections up. So you're onto it, and we still have to kind of tweak that out, and you'll see the revisions later when we've better aligned those two sections.
Okay, thank you very much.
Commissioner Fuller, we're to you.
Right, thank you. I generally like all of the residential parking requirements, including the mixed use. However, in mixed use, I didn't see anywhere where it denoted that the spaces couldn't be garaged or segregated, like some developments mm-hmm. may have. Benefits because they're mixed use, but then they end up taking and making the residential units garage units and therefore not available to be used by the businesses during business hours. So if they were going to benefit from this, then I would just say that make sure that all spaces are available on that part. On the balance of this, I have a pretty big problem. We have about four pages here, all the other uses, and I just went and looked at the City of Santa Barbara's parking requirements, and for office and commercial and industrial uses, they have one paragraph outside of the general business district. The county has one page, and I don't believe that, you know, it's a new sort of planning idea that you have parking related to the use of the property, but most buildings can be used for multiple purposes within a zone. And therefore, you know, you may have a takeout facility in a building at one point in time. You may have a sit-down restaurant in the same building at another point in time, mm-hmm. unless you're absolutely going to say, no, you can't do that, which then is putting an extra burden on any developer or any property. The flexibility to use the same building in a zoning classification is something that, you know, people kind of expect that they're going to be able to do. But if they don't have the parking, then either you're going to tell them, no, you can't do that because you don't have the parking, mm-hmm.
or you're going to tell everybody when they build a building in that zoning classification that they're going to abide by the same parking standards. So in case somebody decides that they're going to have a higher intensity of use of that property, the parking is there and they're not creating a burden on the other neighborhoods or the other businesses. So I really like, you know, the city of Santa Barbara's standards, which are four spaces per 1,000 square feet in offices and commercial properties. And actually, from my time in the commercial real estate business, it was generally considered that 5 per 1,000 for retail is more appropriate. And in warehouse space, the city of Santa Barbara has 1 per 500 square feet. So, you know, I just find what we're delineating here is probably overly inadequate in most of these zones. And that you'd just be lucky that, you know, when somebody has an office building and they're fully utilizing it, they will continue to utilize that space and continue to put employees in there if they can, whether or not they have the parking for it. And therefore, those people are going to park somewhere, creating additional burdens. I think it's best that we think of a worst case scenario or a maximum use scenario and just kind of have a standard and a more simplified table of requirements here. There's that. And then one other specific thing, going to community assembly, one space for four permanent seats. These days, although a lot of younger people may be using buses, there's still a lot of people that show up as an individual person in a vehicle and take up one seat. And now, if you have a really popular event or popular church, you may have spilling over into the neighborhood. Again, you know, unintended, you know, impacts. I think that that's definitely too low. Maybe one space for every two seats. And then you still have your thinking that people are going to show up as couples or maybe ride together, which would be great. Okay.
Okay, we're going to continue with the next table, so get ready.
Well, that's a general overview on most of it. So.
Commissioner Jenkins, I saw you wanting to make a comment.
Right, and I'm going to get into 126 and 127 as well, but I did want to just mention to Commissioner Fuller, City of Santa Barbara is simplified, but they also have a ton of parking structures. And so there's a whole parking district downtown that allows for development to occur without requiring it on site.
Right, and they do have a whole separate section for, you know, central business district to development and because of that. But I'm talking about their standards for outside of the central business district, and they still have a lot of areas outside of the central business district.
And that's their current ordinance, and I believe they're in the process of changing it.
And we do have the project manager for Santa Barbara here to speak to it as well. So. Yeah.
So with the parking standards, there's a number of ways to kind of approach it and address it, and all of them have their pros and cons. So coming up with one standard for a big group of uses can have a lot of benefit in adaptive reuse and changes of uses and flexibility with that. What is hard, though, is a takeout restaurant will have, in actuality, a much different parking demand than a sit-down restaurant even, or another food and beverage type use. So while you've made it easier for uses to switch over and easier in administration, there can be some unintended consequences as actually meeting parking demand. Requiring worst case scenario parking, that is what we've tended to do. That's actually where we've gone in the planning world for a long time. And what we found is that we have seas of parking lots and impermeable surfaces, and that really the parking lots are only full at peak time. And so we've seen a real problem with that, not only with that environmental effect, but the ability for uses and things to develop, because parking is one of the biggest constraints as far as what you can achieve on a property. So there is some problems with requiring too much parking. The city of Santa Barbara is with their update, looking at some ways of trying to even further combine parking requirements and types of uses. But they are running into that same struggle of sometimes there's a problem here if we don't require enough, but if we require too much, there's trade-offs with all of it. So everybody is struggling with the same thing. The approach that the city took in this update is trying to make it really clear by identifying each individual use classification. So you can go to, here's my use, here's my parking requirement, and with an idea of what might be a reasonable requirement, much of it based on what's required now and the different effects that the city has seen with that as it's been implemented. And then you'll see a number of uses that say, as determined by zoning administrator, which some people have complained about, but there are some of those uses that we really don't know how much parking a cemetery, you know, is going to demand. And we'd look at that on a case-by-case basis. And that being said, there are different approaches. There's different trade-offs with each, and I think some general direction from your commission on how you would like to go. If some jurisdictions will take a hybrid approach where they'll take all public and semi-public uses require this much parking, except, and then take a couple and identify specific parking requirements for those. So it is breaking this long table, you know, down a little bit further. That's kind of a hybrid approach too. But you're right. There's a lot of pros to combining, but there's a lot to think about with whichever approach that you take.
We've seen this style used very efficiently by the public. They come in, they know exactly what's required. They know the following pages talk about modifications and credits to lower parking standards. If you're concerned about underparking, those are specific areas where we could look at increasing those requirements. And if the commission wanted to look at a different process, we certainly could. But note that there are other restrictions or credits, which if it's an underparking situation, I know you don't like those either. But that is something that this whole chapter works together. And it's while having just a paragraph makes it seemingly simpler, it ends up for the implementation of it really not that simple because there's a lot of subjective interpretation and you were looking for consistency with what someone's getting over the counter from a planner, and that can't change depending on which planner they talk to.
Okay, go ahead. Unless it's going to be a generalized statement, because I want to get through the specifics on this table.
Well, if I can address the discussion.
Go ahead.
Thank you. So almost any developer will be thrilled to provide less parking than is required, you know, to provide the minimum and gain the maximum square footage. You know, it's sort of an axiom amongst those people. So when they show up at the planning department, that's, you know, that's what they're looking for in general, you know, is to maximize their rentable square footage. I can tell you, though, that after that property is built, it's going to be living in our community for 100, 150 years. And working with both owners of properties and lessees of properties, the number one thing they ask is, what is the parking ratio of that property? That's the number one concern in my years, and now I haven't done it for a while, but that's been the number one concern. First off is, what is the parking ratio? The second one is windows, but that's a whole different, you know, thing. But the number one concern is, you know, is there going to be adequate parking for what the business is going to do or what their employees are going to be? And that directly affects the value of the property as well as the rate that it can bring in. And the fact that if you don't plan for peak use or, you know, maximum use of the building, you're creating situations, maybe temporary, where the rest of the community is going to suffer because they're going to bear the burden of that peak moment. Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Jenkins. You're on 126 and 127.
126 and 127. Under residential uses in table 1739040A, single unit dwelling, two spaces for dwelling unit plus one space if the unit contains 3,000 square feet. Commissioner Maynard just had me pause on that, and I think I tend to agree with her, is that do we need to trigger a third car garage just because, based on square footage? And I'm struggling with a little bit. I understand we've got it, but we're also attempting to put these garages at the back and to attempt to get on the side and to do side entry, you know, not have a garage doors facing the street, and all of a sudden you're talking about doing that with three cars. It's problematic.
That's in our parking code now.
It is.
Uh-huh.
Okay. All right. And then fractions under one bedroom, we've got 1.5 spaces, which is very common, but are we helping the public by stating that we're rounding up or down with regards to the fraction? And that's all I have on 126 and 127.
Commissioner Daniels, anything on 126 and 127?
Well, I'd like to ask staff about the fraction. Is it 0.5, is it down, or is it up?
Okay. So we're looking for clarification on that.
Okay.
Just to spell it out.
I got clarification. So I don't. Why do you show 1.5 instead of 2?
Well, this is a multiple unit dwelling where this happens. So it's 1.5 multiplied by however many units are in that building. Yes,
if you have two.
And Commissioner Daniels, the fractional part is spelled out in the rules and measure.
Oh, it is.
It's been a while since we have reviewed that, but.
Anything else, Mr. Daniels?
Not on these pages.
Okay, so a couple comments on page 126 under group residential. We use the terminology unit, one space per unit. I don't know if the correct terminology should there be room versus unit, because I'm not sure what a unit is defined by. Under skilled nursing facility, we are also using the terminology unit. Would that be room? But of course, in a skilled nursing, you could have multiple beds in a room. So I'm not sure that the unit terminology is what we should have in those two cases. And then I will just make an overarching comment. I'm very comfortable with this these tables and the specificity of it. I'm not down to the debate of specific allowances necessarily. But I do also, I would be resistant to the idea of worst or maximum use scenario across the board, because in that case, there are obviously uses that would have more parking than needed to be effective. By definition, that would occur. And the only time it would be the correct amount is when that maximum use existed in that location. So I think we'd be overparked as a general, and I would have a difficulty with going to that, especially as we evolve in our transportation uses and demand for those kind of things. I think we would be remiss to put that in. But I am comfortable with the idea of these tables that line it out, make it very specific and distinguishable. Just to argue with you, Ed.
Sure.
So, with that being said, I'm going to let you go on 128 and 129.
All right, since I can be specific here, I think banks and financial institutions should be more like 5 per 1,000. Bars and nightclubs and lounges, 150 square feet per parking space. That's a 10 by 15 foot area. I don't know if anybody's been to a nightclub lately, but when they're popular, there's about 15 people in a 10 by 15 foot area. So that could be huge overspill onto neighbors. But they're different, probably at a different time of the day. So if those spaces are available, it may not be such a problem. Restaurants, that's 75 feet is a 7 by 10 area. That's one space. That definitely seems too inadequate, and that's of the customer seating area. So in a 7 by 10 foot area, including the walkway, you're likely to have, at lunchtime, if it's full or nearly full, you're likely to have at least four people there, meaning at least two cars for that. And on the next page, offices, business and professions, three I think is close, but I think it should be four per thousand or one for every 250 square feet. Medical and dental, again, that you're likely to have people stacked up there waiting to see the dentist or the doctor, one per 200. Retail and general sales, one per 200, as has been the historical desire for retail operators of general nature. Industrial uses, R&D. R&D is pretty often it's an office use, and 600 square feet for one space is likely also to be vastly underparked. I think that most of these numbers, the warehouse and the laboratory, are also too large for per number. Maybe some in-depth research on what current standards are by the people who use these might be good. I might be wrong. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Maynard, any comments on 128 and 129?
Yes, if you don't mind, I'll just go back for one very quick second, because as we were talking, it made me think of a few other things. On page 127, where it talks about the sustainable living research site, don't we also, part of the requirement of approving that is through a conditional use permit, so wouldn't we review that through the conditional use permit, or would that be the zoning administrator?
We would need to, that whole section needs to be re-looked at.
So we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Okay, so then I'll do one general comment, and then I'll get into 128. My general comment, going back to the dialogue we've had so far, I like that this is very clear and spelled out. I like that this balances between over and under parking, so I really appreciate that. Through the conversation, though, I was convinced that we might want to think about making the restaurants more lumped together, because I think about the fact that a lot of restaurants, sadly, it's a very difficult business, and they turn over very quickly, and so that might be an area where we want less differentiation, so there's more flexibility for new restaurants to take over a restaurant space. So that might just be one area that I was thinking about there. But otherwise, I do actually think staff took the right approach here, and I'm very excited about that approach. There was a comment that was made on, or a discussion, I should really say, on DRB about service and gas stations and whether the pump counts as a parking space. And I wanted to support the idea that the pump should count as a parking space when it's just a gas station and a convenience store. I might feel differently if there was, say, a restaurant associated with the gas station, as there are at some rest stops. But I do think the pump should be considered as a potential space there. And then for offices, particularly large office buildings, I think you got it right. I'd keep the amount of parking that's here. I wouldn't support a reduction in parking, especially because I think for large offices, there's a lot of potential for carpooling and vanpool services. I'd like to, especially for large offices, to allow for more alternative transportation there. That's everything on 129.
I got you already right, Mr. Follett?
Yeah, you did.
Mm-hmm. Commissioner Jenkins?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Under the restaurants, restaurant takeout only just has two spaces for establishment. If you have two employees, all of your spaces are full. So it just seems like that's not enough. And I appreciate Commissioner Maynard's comment about maybe lumping restaurants together because of the huge turnover. Under page 129, hotels and motels, time and share uses. I'm just curious under this if we've thought about employee parking as well, because it seems like we may be for that. And under personal services, just seems like there's a typo, one space, one per 350. Seems like there's an extra one in there. And that's all I have.
Commissioner Daniels, anything on the tables on page 128 and 129?
No.
I will support the comment on 128 service and gas stations about the fuel bays counting towards parking. I think that has been up for debate on occasions. And the concept of having restaurants be consistent, because that has a lot of merit in my mind as well, because of the turnover. I'm on 129, and under industrial uses, we have some variation, some very fine points there. one space for 2,000 in custom, and then general and limited at 1,500, and I'm not sure that there should be any variation within that, in the under the industrial, that perhaps that could be unified and simplified. Those uses are very difficult to discern. So I'm now going to go to page 130 and 131, and let's go 130. Are we going to need a break here shortly, group? Anybody? Or we go a little longer?
How much further for the end of parking?
We've got days. I mean, we are going to have a hard time getting where we, the opportunity that was presented to us today. So I think we go until we can't go any longer, but if you're good, let's go a little bit longer and see if we need a break.
Okay.
Who was I just with? Commissioner, who was I with on 130 and 131? Commissioner Maynard, did I throw that at you right away? Okay. Commissioner Jenkins.
All right, 130. At the bottom, under floor area, again, I would prefer net versus gross.
Okay.
And on page 131, under D, exemptions for small commercial uses. And this is one of those things, if you forgive me, I've got to reacquaint myself with my notes here. We've got in C districts, the following commercial uses are not required to provide on-site parking when they contain less than 1,500 square feet of floor area. Sales, personal services, eating, drinking establishments. And I'm just curious the reasoning on that. And I did some math. I said, so if you had an area that had multiple restaurants, say you had a small little strip mall and you had four restaurants, so you had, or gosh, I had under parking, so I had four for retail sales, and I forget if this came from the graph, but I was coming up with four times 1,500 square feet is 6,000 square feet, which would equal 80 spaces for full service restaurants. And I'm just not quite sure that makes sense.
Would you repeat that?
Yeah.
Because I'm not sure I followed you.
Well, give me a second. And okay. Let me just, because like I say, I'm reading these notes from months ago or weeks ago. Contain less than 1,500 square feet for floor area. Retail sales, and I don't know where I came up with the number four. It must have been from the graph.
Third sentence from the bottom.
Yeah, when four or more are on the lot, or more than four, all the areas must be aggregated.
So four or less.
Right. Okay.
6,000 square feet, you wouldn't need any parking.
Yeah.
That's not true.
Okay.
6,000 square feet would have to be aggregated and figure out what the parking would be.
It's more than four.
So, right. So that could be something
four.
If it's three or two or... Yeah. We find, I have found in other places that I have worked is, this exemption helps really tiny businesses get started. They're usually startups of some sort or very small retail uses. 1,500 square feet isn't very big. And when they're on separate lots, like in a strip or a common lot in a strip mall, clearly this wouldn't apply. These are the freestanding, very small lot businesses that just need a little oomph to get started, and they may not have the parking. So it's a tool. It may not always be applicable. And we don't have a lot of freestanding parcels in town that could accommodate for such businesses like this. Mm-hmm. They are usually in a single lot in a strip shopping context. So,
okay. Well, Mr. Chair, it was a what-if thought, I'm sure, when I wrote this. It made a lot of sense when I wrote it, but it's not making much sense now. So,
okay.
Thanks for your indulgence.
Commissioner Daniels, anything on page 130 and 131?
No, sir.
Commissioner Fuller?
No.
Commissioner Maynard?
I have a comment on 131. C, sites with multiple uses. And my question is, what if the uses aren't at the same time? So I know pop-up restaurants, as an example, have become more popular both in Old Town and in downtown Santa Barbara. If the two uses are at defined separate times, could we just go with the maximum of the two uses rather than both if both aren't going to be happening, if both uses aren't overlapping? So I'd like a little bit more consideration for that.
And that covered both pages? So I'll just make the comment on 130 under freight truck terminals, warehouses, the one space for 1,000. That should probably, whatever we land on in industrial uses, have a similarity to that, whether it's 2,000, 1,500, or 1,000, whatever it is. But I think the similarity exists there. I have a note about Owen Street, but I think that will set. So we're to page 132 and 133. Commissioner Maynard, are you ready? Go ahead.
Actually, I think the staff actually addressed my issue on 133, so I have no comments.
Okay. Anything for you, Commissioner Fuller?
Mm-hmm. So I don't think I saw anywhere previously where it talked about motor scooter parking or motorcycle parking, except in this portion. Is that correct? Right? Okay. So it's only being offered, I mean, it's only being encouraged as a parking reduction. I think that motorcycle parking should be a requirement, for at least one out of 10 spaces. To start, and then one for every 20 spaces. A transit accessibility should be a half a mile, not three quarters of a mile. I'll agree on, I think it was Cecilia Brown or somebody brought that up as a point. I think three quarters of a mile is too far. People can always use their own shopping carts to carry stuff, but still three quarters of a mile when you're carrying stuff is, or dragging stuff as well, ways.
Okay. And does that include 133?
No. I don't believe there should be a reduction in parking requirements in the Old Town Zoning District.
Okay. So, Commissioner Maynard, did I give you 132 and 133?
So I did actually get to comment on this before, but I wanted to respond to the comment about Old Town. I think Old Town's already been developed out to the point that a lot of very small restaurants that don't have a lot of parking, I support being able to support the existing restaurants there with the constraints that it's already been designed around. So that would be my concern.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins, 132, 133.
Nothing on 32. 133, I under the E1, I was just curious if we wanted to add with ZA or PC approval, zoning administrator or planning commission approval.
One.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Anything else?
That's it.
Commissioner Daniels, anything on page 132, 133?
Negative.
All right. So, Commissioner Daniels, why don't you take us 134 and 135?
Okay. 134 was, we did that a few weeks ago. So it's already in the computer, I should say.
Okay, about the RV parking?
Yeah.
Did we cover all the other stuff on that page?
The only thing that was not addressed was the 1, 2, 3, 4 at the very top of the page.
Okay.
4-134. Because we did cover residential uses.
Only number 3 under residential uses was covered. 1 and 2 were not discussed.
I think that's what I recollect there, that we just went right to that recreational vehicle parking and addressed that issue.
And staff is working on alternative language for you to consider in the revised version.
Good.
I've got something for 135.
For 135, go ahead.
Bike parking. I'm having trouble making bike parking and land use something that we have to do.
Okay.
It's.
All right.
So.
Anything else on that page?
No.
Commissioner Jenkins?
I just had a note under C1B, non-residential uses. Any off-site parking must be located within 400 feet. And I'm just curious, have we always used that dimension, or has it been 500 feet in the past?
Okay. Anything else on those two pages? Mr. Jenkins?
That's it. Sorry.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller.
I hate to revisit the RV again, but I felt I was misled by most of the speakers that came up and said that they were doing something that was legal, when in fact one of them pointed out in a submittal with the county's regulations that it said specifically and very clearly that RVs were not to be parked within the front yard setback. So I just wanted to, you know, make the point that all those people that thought they were doing something illegal by parking in the front yard setback were actually doing something illegal that's been illegal forever, I guess, since the county adopted that. So that, I just want to make that comment. I like the short-term bicycle parking.
All right, Commissioner Maynard.
On page 134 at the top of the page, this is under a section for parking in lieu fees and is the use of funds, section B. I think that bicycle infrastructure should be something that the fees could be spent on. So I'd like to see that included there. For 1739070A1, for not speaking of RVs for a moment, it says required parking cannot be within the required setback. And again, I'd like it that the driveway for a vehicle could count as a parking space for that vehicle. And I will just say that I maintain the views that I shared last week at the last meeting on RVs. So I have not changed my views on that. And that's it for 134. I do have comments on 135.
Go ahead.
Under 1739080, I am delighted that you have included the bicycle parking here and support that. For A1B, you have the exceptions for cemeteries and community gardens, and I don't see a rationale for that exception. So I'd like to hear more from staff at some point about why there's exceptions for cemeteries or community gardens, or maybe take that exception out. I also liked a suggestion from the design review board about adding bus stops as something that has required parking spaces. And then there was also a discussion on the design review board that I thought was very helpful around 1739080A2. Talking about the location and whether the bike parking needed to be outside of the public right-of-way or not. I think the intent here is that there is an adequate sidewalk space, and so I think that should really be determined based on the size of the sidewalk. I really like the language that comes up later, specific to Old Town. It's on the next page, 136B, and maybe that could be extended outside of Old Town. And that's all my comments on 135.
All right. So I think everybody had a shot at 134, 135. The only comment I have that wasn't mentioned here on the last item on page 135, number two, the final on short-term bicycle parking says within 50 feet of main entrance to the building it serves. And I'm just questioning whether that is the best suited spot for that, and that restriction should be maintained for short-term bicycle parking. So let's go to page 136 and 137. Commissioner Daniels, do you have anything on 136 or 137?
Negative.
All right. Commissioner Jenkins?
Just on 137, under item 2, location, I'm not familiar with the term surface lot. Are you talking about parking lot? It's just, I'm not sure what...
structure or surface lot. Okay. Anything else on that page?
That's all.
Commissioner Fuller?
So I'm going to be rather equal opportunity here between cars and bicycles. B1A, one long-term bicycle parking space for every 5 units in a multi-unit residential group, residential project. I think almost everybody has a bike, which means there's probably 2 per unit. I would think that at least one long-term bicycle parking space per unit would be more appropriate, and probably still have people wishing that there was more. But then on page 137B, I think that that ratio, instead of one space per 20 vehicles, should be more like 1 per 5 vehicles or 1 per 10. I'm sure we're talking, you know, not short term here. We're talking, this isn't visitors coming and finding a bicycle parking space. This is employees having a place to park their bike while they're at work. If we want to encourage people to use the bikes, we should be providing places for them to park the bikes. And hopefully there'll be enough people using them to fully utilize these bike spaces. Public or private parking, you know, one space per 50 vehicles with a minimum of one long-term space, that just seems completely inadequate. If we're going to have a public or private parking use, they should also provide some reasonable amount of long-term bicycle parking, in my opinion. 1 per 5 or 1 per 10 there also. That's my opinion. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Maynard.
Yes. So under B1A, the long-term bicycle parking, I support a 1-to-1 ratio. I also think that that needs to be increased. This is a general comment that goes into the long-term bicycle section. Not sure if it's appropriate here, but on out at UCSB, one of the things we've found is one of the role drivers encouraging people to use bicycle commuting is whether there's showers available. So I would like to encourage a consideration of somewhere in the zoning code, I'm not sure if this is the right place or elsewhere, that we think about maybe requiring showers for large employers. So like in a large office building, as an example, might require a certain number of showers for commuting bicyclists. Under covered spaces, I'd like to see that in residential areas, that, and particularly for multi-use residential, that we do covered in 100% of those situations rather than 50%. I think 50% is more appropriate in commercial, but for residential, 100% would be better. For size and accessibility number, this is B5 on page 137. Design Review Board brought up a recommendation that there's some high-density racks that might be able to do this with less than a 2-foot width, and I thought that was a good suggestion to encourage. Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. And I think that is... everything that I've got, and I guess also I'll support what Commissioner Fuller said on page 137C, public or private parking use, that we should have more bicycle parking there as well.
Commissioner Jenkins.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I just, Commissioner Maynard brought up the suggestion of under number 3 on page 137, covered spaces going 100%. I just have a problem with that from the standpoint that we don't require 100% covered parking for automobiles, and what's the nexus for requiring 100% covered parking for bicycles? And it just seems like, you know, especially for long term, it just, that's a lot of coverage. So that's a lot of structure that you know will be a visual impact as well. So I would hesitate to go there.
Anything else on those pages?
That's it. Thank you.
Commissioner Daniels, anything on those two pages, 136 and 137?
No.
Okay. I do have a comment on the covered spaces, and I'm not supportive of even the 50% rule. Mm. It seems excessive, and I understand, certainly I'm not looking to limit access for bicycle parking, but long-term parking in a lot of situations is accommodatable within the existing structures, whether they be garages or other places. So, and I don't see from our bicycle parking that it offsets car parking. We put, as we go through this, we have a lot of additional requirements in the parking side of things, you know, from electrical vehicle and ride sharing and, of course, handicap. And there is, and I shouldn't use the terminology handicap, that's not the disabled, specialty parking, whatever. But I just think that we're going to another extremes with the bicycle parking in addition to. So that was my general comment. 138. We're going to require loading spaces. Mr. Daniels, can you take us to 138 and 139 if you have any comments there?
I don't have comments on 138. 139, my comments are the head of this citation is just parking area design and development standards.
And I'm sorry, what was your comment?
I am talking about the head of the citation, and it's parking area design and development standards.
The ongoing design standards within the zoning?
Yes.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins?
I have nothing on these two pages.
Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good.
Commissioner Maynard?
I have one comment on page 139 under parking area design and development standards. Perhaps consideration of required pedestrian walkways through lots. I think of the really large shopping center lots that sometimes it's not particularly safe to get through the parking lot. So a little bit more requirements of pedestrian walkway through the space.
All right, Commissioner Maynard, why don't you look at the next two pages of 140 and 141 and see if you have any comments there.
I do. I was looking at this 7-foot width, particularly when it's a sidewalk rather than a landscaped area, and if the cars can hang over 2 feet on each side, that leaves 3 feet of sidewalk left. And so I just wanted to make sure we're conscientious of the accessibility guidelines. I know in other places we're looking for at least a 4 to 6 foot sidewalk. And with the hangover, I don't know if we achieve that. So that was just something to take a look at. And I'll let them comment on that. And I think... I think for carpool and vanpool parking, at least 10% of the required parking. I wanted to also see this for large employers, not just the office, but other large employers as well.
All right, Commissioner Fuller, anything on those two pages?
I'm good.
Commissioner Jenkins?
I don't have anything on these two pages, although I did catch a snippet of the DRB discussion over parking, and there was a lot of good discussion that was brought up as far as aisle widths and planter dimensions, and I don't want to go into that again to repeat it, but I think staff should listen very carefully to that input. I thought it was excellent. So that's it for
Commissioner Daniels. 40. We're on page 140 and 141.
Nothing. Thank you.
Okay. I will make a comment. 141F, the bottom of the page, carpool and vanpool parking. I'm again concerned with the required set aside. rather than they be part of the normal parking structure. I mean, because they're called out, they won't be used for other parking. So I have a problem with that designation because it means that general parking is reduced. You can accommodate it without calling it out. All right, so we're on page 142 and 143. Who's ready? Commissioner Fuller, are you ready?
Yeah, I think so. On 143J, I think we may want to revisit that standard in the not too distant future. I think there's going to be a lot more demand for charging, although it may be inductive in the future. I think we might want to consider permeable paving for larger amounts of paving in general, as well as non-reflective or the use of reflective and light-colored materials for to reduce heat sinking. Thank you.
Commissioner Maynard.
On page 142H3, I wonder if 20 feet in depth would be required if you're not also using your driveway for some parking. So if you're not using it towards the parking requirement, that seems like a lot. So maybe some more flexibility there. Under electric vehicle now I've moved to page 143J, electric vehicle charging stations. There's a piece about offices here, and I guess I wonder what percentage of the building needs to be offices. I think of research facilities, hospitals, light manufacturing. Maybe it should really be about how many employees there are, but I'd like to see maybe offices expanded there. For permeable paving, similar, I think maybe requiring this for large lots. Not picking on the smaller projects, but at least for large lots, requiring that.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Under page 142, 4D, maximum driveway widths for non-residential uses just appears to be excessive to me, the 20 feet and the 33 feet. And then on page 143, K3, talking about turf grids and grassy pavers. I love the look, but under a drought issue and you know, it just seems like we may be dealing with droughts on a fairly common basis, if that's sending the wrong message. And that's all I have on those two pages.
Commissioner Daniels?
Nothing on 141. Or 140?
We're on 142 and 143.
Nothing on those?
Neither one of them?
No.
Okay. So I do have a comment on page 143, electrical vehicle charging. I'm not sure that is a valid requirement, and especially as electrical vehicles are developing, the need for on-site charging is going to change dramatically over the years. In fact, until that is not a requirement, electrical vehicles won't become what they can be. So is this a long-term position that we should be mandating? Heat island reduction. Interesting that we say those areas not landscaped, 50% should be shaded. And I'm concerned with that in the sense of, does it require additional structures, or what does how is that accomplished to create that reduction in heat in the heat islands? We call out some things there, but it is significant. 50% of non-landscaped area must be shaded. That's a significant requirement in parking areas.
Or it can have the light covered materials. Or a combination of shading and the light-covered materials. So light-colored asphalt also reduces the heat island effect.
Okay. All right, so we're going to page... How are we doing? Can we keep going, mm-hmm. or do we need a break?
Right. If we could get through parking.
Yeah, let's get through parking.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, good. We'll keep going then. Commissioner Maynard, have you got something for 144 and 145?
Yes, so I'll just make a quick comment on 143 that I support the heat island language that's currently there. And then I'll move through 144 because I have no comments. On 145, as I was listening to DRB, something occurred to me that perhaps we should look at some more flexibility and really focus on what our goals are. So perhaps something like the percentage of the parking lot that has to be landscaped, rather than saying it's got to be exactly 8 feet or some foot dimension, but really focusing on what our core goals are, which to me would be the amount of area within the parking lot that's landscaped. So just a suggestion for flexibility there. And that's everything I have for 145.
144 and 145?
That is correct.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller.
I'm good.
You're good. Commissioner Jenkins.
Just a couple things on 145. 6C, I'm sorry, 6B talks about all parking measurements are to face of curb. And I know we're talking about islands, but are we to the inside or the outside face of curb? So, you know, on the parking lot side or the planter side, where is that measured from? And then E down below, for rows of more than 16 spaces, landscape islands must be staggered. I think a diagram would be very helpful here. That's all I have.
Commissioner Daniels?
Nothing on 144 or 145.
Okay. So I'll make a comment on, I'm a little confused so we do have landscape area required. So it says a 10% of parking lot. And I think you just mentioned something about size of meridians or whether it's a percentage of parking. So we have on O2, a minimum of 10% of any parking lot area must be landscaped. Now, my comment on that, I highlighted because I wondered if there should be a differential in some of the districts, for instance, industrial versus, you know, I understand parking that is visible and used by the general public, but would that be the same, for instance, in a contractor's storage yard?
For me, I would. So differential by district, I think I'd be open to exploring that. My concern with that would be that some of my reasoning for the landscaping is not just aesthetic, but the heat island effect, the stormwater management, the increased permeability. So I'd want to make sure that if we are doing it different by district, that we are looking at some of those other environmental impacts of having parking lots with no landscaping.
Okay. I'll still make that comment there because for industrial uses where larger vehicles, and we have lots of certainly 20,000 square feet or less in this city for those uses, landscaping almost would make those unusable for those kind of operations. Mm-hmm. Let's see, parking lot landscape. So. On required landscape islands on A, so I'm just reading that, and again, just like you, Mr. Jenkins, I made some of these comments some time ago.
I'm glad I'm not the only one.
Zoning proposed increased by at least 10%. So if it is found that the overall amount of landscaping proposed is increased by at least 10% from that required on the entire development site. 10% of the development site. So it doesn't go from a 10% to a 20%. It goes from a 10% to 11%? It
goes from 10% to 20%, and then you get something for that.
Okay.
So it's an incentive.
Okay. So increased landscaping gets you some other incentive.
Yes. You get to have more stalls that are contiguous than what would normally be required. Okay. And it's important to note that this is only in parking areas of 10 or more spaces.
Okay, mm-hmm. Thank you. And then the light item on F, we have a limitation 15 continuous parking spaces. I just called it out because it was a specific limitation that the covered has to be broken up from those areas, whether that's valid or not.
And DRB pointed out that often those the covered parking canopies come in even numbered lengths. So we'll look at that number.
Okay. So now we're at page 146 and 147. Mr. Daniels, do you have anything on these two pages?
Negative, sir. Thank you.
Commissioner Jenkins?
No.
Commissioner Fuller?
I'm good.
Commissioner Maynard?
Just a brief comment about perhaps on page 147 where it talks about medians with sidewalks again. When are sidewalks required? Just a comment.
Thank you. I have no comments on those pages. 148 and 149. Commissioner Maynard, have you got anything there?
I'll stay in the same theme. I have no comments for 148. For 149, under circulation and safety, again, for particularly large lots, I'd like to see routes from the bike path, any bike paths that come up to the property, that they would be continued through the lot to the bike parking, and just thinking about how bike paths might be able to make it through large lots, and those sidewalk requirements.
Commissioner Fuller, you're up.
Looks good.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Ditto.
Commissioner Daniels? 148 and 149.
What Gregory said.
Okay. All right, so last page on parking. Anything on that, Commissioner Daniels, page 150?
No.
Commissioner Jenkins?
No.
Commissioner Fuller?
It looks good.
Commissioner Maynard?
No comments.
Wow. Okay. So we just got through parking and loading.
Yeah.
840-something?
46.
Are we ready for break?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Actually, could I make a question? So I know we have some folks in the audience here from the interfaith community, and I'm not sure if we're going to get to their section tonight. Is it possible that we could consider after break doing something like we did with the RV parking, where we address some of the hours of those operations so that they don't have to be here for another meeting? I know they've come and talked about it at prior meetings, and then again tonight. I'd hate them to have to come back again.
Thank you. I think that's a great suggestion. Why don't we take a very quick five-minute break and get back and get to that item, and then see what our durability is after that.
Okay.
Maynard on the community assembly, which is 1742090 on page 189. Everybody there?
Mm-hmm.
Let's skip to that item.
Whoa, 189.
Yep.
On page 190.
Yeah, and then it goes through, it's really the substance of it. The title is 189, and we go to 190. All right. So, does staff want to give us a little bit of background information here?
So, we were contacted by Reverend Miller and other members of the community with concerns about the time frames for hours of operation listed in Section E. And we met with a large group, as I stated earlier, and we do need to go back and take a look at that. Under federal rules, we're not allowed to treat religious assembly differently than we would treat community assembly. So this code was an attempt to put them all together. So there's been some thought to separating. There's been other thoughts to just eliminating hours of operation. And so Ms. Miller can speak more to it, but we were gonna go take this back, kind of like we did with the RV language, take this back and give it another shot, knowing the desires and needs of the religious community that have come and talked to us, or the interfaith community, I should say. So.
Ms. Miller.
So I think what would be helpful from your commission is to, similar to the RV, of what you would kind of like to see in that and what you'd like us to look at. And again, the biggest issue is the question of the timing of operation. And just a little kind of background of that, there was the question of bringing, why is this even there? And Because where community assembly uses are allowed in a wide variety of districts, and including the residential districts, there is some concern of compatibility with neighboring uses. And it can be noise, general activity, traffic, and so on. So it doesn't seem that we totally hit the mark with this, but there was never the intention to prohibit, but require a higher level of discretionary review to be able to look at the case-by-case basis to make sure there is compatibility. But you've heard varying opinions on the draft in here, so we'd like to get your reaction so when we go back and look through everything, we can make sure we're incorporating your feelings.
Great. Commissioner Maynard, you get your first opportunity to comment on this section.
Sure. We have a great section on noise, which we might even get through tonight. And I think the noise section does address the issues that are concerned in terms of compatibility. So what I would recommend is to drop 1742.090E, the hours of operation. Outside of even the interfaith community, I know that for when I was growing up, some of the other types of things we did in community assemblies overnight, I remember going to the aquarium and doing an overnight sleepover at the aquarium with my Girl Scout troop. I think there's a lot of things that you might do overnight. I think of out at UCSB, there's a student group that does dance marathon where you dance for 24 hours as a fundraiser. I could see that at the Goleta Valley Community Center. So I could see a number of different uses, and I think the noise ordinance or the noise section under the performance standards that we'll look at in a bit, I think it covers this, and I think it addresses the concerns that this is intended to address. So I don't think there should be hours of operation. If folks are quiet at night but still operating, I think that's okay.
Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah, I'd just like a little more explanation as to what is considered a community assembly use, what it could include. I think that's part of the problem I have is that it may not just be religious observances or gatherings, that it could be other events.
So if you take a look at your use classifications on page 6-3, I think that's 6. Reading Roman numerals here.
Okay.
That does get into what the definition for community assembly is.
Okay, thank you. And you can go to somebody else while I do that.
Okay. Commissioner Jenkins.
Well, I, what page were we on?
We were on 190.
I went to turn to follow. Okay. I had made notes to myself that the hours were unreasonable for E, and I noticed that even for adult businesses, they were allowed to go from 8 a.m. to 11 p.m., so they had a larger area of time. And I thought, what about the 24-hour prayer vigils and this and that? So I would agree that we could probably delete E and remove the hours of operation. And I agree with Commissioner Maynard about, we do have a noise ordinance as well, and so the enforcement, although that would probably be complaint driven at that point, I'm curious as to how that the member of the public calls and it's loud, and if the sheriff shows up, does he have a decibel reader, how is that enforced, I guess is the question. But I would support deleting E.
Okay. Commissioner Daniels?
It might be more work, but in my mind, you need two different performance standards. One specific to the community, and one specific to the rest of the uses. That way. Our director showed us a community assembly, and there's no There is no hours on that at all. I don't know if there was supposed to be or not. And, you know, it's. It is what it is, and that's good. So, you know, I think two specifics. Specific to the, can I say, churches, would be a good way to do it, you know, and make it more clear. It would make it more clear in my mind. Okay.
Okay.
You got it?
Yep.
Staff would also like to know, there was also concern about the minimum site area and the front yard parking, and we are also going back and relooking at those requirements as well and see how they would relate from one use to another and come up with something a little bit different for you to review in the future.
Okay, so the only comment, I'm not opposed to eliminating E. Obviously, if it's consolidated to all community assembly, then that makes that more a little more problematic, eliminating that situation and whether we separate them out. But I would certainly suggest that for either use that we look at an administrative permit rather than a conditional use permit on this as the first stage of dealing with a variance in hours from the standard. It just seems logical that we wouldn't necessarily go up to the next level. And obviously, there needs to be some way for the neighborhood or the adjoining properties to understand what the uses are on the site. That's an advantage of permitting an administrative permit, that they're aware that these are standard and allowed uses. But obviously, we need to do something here to accommodate the needs that have been spelled out to us from the community over several meetings. Concerned with the limitation.
An administrative permit can also be brought to the Planning Commission if there was a thought that it would be controversial or would be a particular community impact.
Yeah, I would rather see it start there than start with a conditional use permit, just because of the burden of that. Commissioner Fuller.
Thank you. What are our current regulations as far as time? Do we have any?
No.
Oh, all right, so we don't. So we're now talking about imposing something that we don't already have. Okay. Next question. If somebody came, if a religious organization came for an administrative permit, would we have grounds to deny it? I mean, a religious organization has the right of assembly and, you know, practice of their faith. So, you know, I would think that if they were going to have a, you know, midnight vigil and they came for a permit, you pretty much couldn't say no.
Well, the permit, oh yeah, additional hours. Well, that would be for the establishment. The permit, that the permit would establish it with the guidelines.
Oh, as a regular use?
That if this was still in place, it would be a regular use.
So they could have a midnight vigil every single night of the week.
If that was their hours or there were no standards.
So my kind of concern is that when you're including many other uses in with, say, religious organizations, that, you know, people, the Church of Rave, you know, could, you know, then be having their weekly, you know, rave and be subject to the noise ordinances, true, but still a burden on the neighborhood. That being said, you know, if we don't have a time restriction at this point, I don't see why we should do it. If there's nobody here, you know, yelling and screaming that we should, it's something that can always be discussed and considered in the future.
Commissioner Maynard.
I think we should be very clear about what we think the burden might be and develop language around the burden rather than putting the time in. Because as you said, the noise ordinance does consider the issues that you're talking about. I think it's inappropriate for us not to allow religious services at night. I also think that I support the federal law that they extend those opportunities outside of the interfaith community to also support other types of community activities. So I recognize that we can't create a differentiation. I think there's a lot of good reasons why we shouldn't be creating a differentiation. And I wouldn't want this to impact somebody's practices. And so I think it's really important that we take out E.
All right. So we're not. Are we going to go another round on that one? We good?
Where do
okay.
We go?
All right. Thank you for staying.
What should I tell the ministers? Think you're going to take it out?
This is a workshop.
It's a workshop.
Yeah, so we didn't come to any decision. Yeah. We're not here to make decisions tonight.
You'll have to come again.
The Planning Commission had favorable consensus.
I would say tell them there's hope.
So, Reverend Miller, the next step would be when we come back for a public hearing with the Planning Commission to actually make a recommendation, there will be an edited version of that document of the zoning ordinance released so you can see what the new language is proposed to be.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, so I'm going to bring us back to performance standards, and I would say our goal right now is to get through this section. When we get through this section, we'll see where we are, if we can go to further, because the next one up is signs after that. And as we know, signs has a lot of discussion potential. So let's go to performance standards on page 151 of this section 17.4. Oh, Commissioner Maynard, do you have anything for that first page?
I have no comments on 151.
Commissioner Fuller?
No comment.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Nothing.
Commissioner Daniels?
Nothing.
I don't have any as well. So, Commissioner Daniels, we are on page 152 and 153. Do you have anything there?
Nothing.
Commissioner Jenkins?
Nothing on 152. On 153, number 2, hazardous materials or waste stored in closed containers at a facility must not be located within 50 feet of the property line. And I would just suggest adding when feasible, from the standpoint that a lot configuration may not allow 50 feet.
Yeah.
And then 3A, testing has been conducted as required to determine to exist in soil. Testing by who? Testing by someone certified? We might want to clarify that. And then are there any test standards that we need to abide by? That's all I have.
Okay. Commissioner Fuller?
Good.
Commissioner Maynard?
I on page 152, 1740070B, I support the language that's there. I know we've had some... So different comments during the public comment, but I actually support keeping the language as is there in B. On page 153, number 1740070C2, perhaps we could say be located within 50 feet of a property line or with administrative use permit. I'd prefer that over when feasible. Okay, and then I don't have any other comments on 153.
Okay. So I do have a comment, 152. So we did have public comment on about identifying that such can has been identified and has accepted financial responsibility. I mean, the ultimate, again, the outcome that we're looking for is to have that remedied. Mm-hmm. The focus should be on remedy rather than necessarily making the party responsible as the only one that can allow that to become usable. So I have a concern with that language. And I'll echo Commissioner Jenkins on the 50-foot property line. I mean, again, we have commercial M1 properties that are 50-foot wide. Hmm. How do you do that? If you got a 50 or 60, if you have a 100-foot deep wide lot, you have to put the hazard material exactly in the middle of the lot to be 50 feet from the nearest property line. Can't be done. So I don't think that's realistic. Certainly isn't in the, because again, that industrial locations is where that would probably be most common. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So that needs some kind of an adjustment. All right, so we're on 154 and 155. Commissioner Jenkins, I'm going to let you go first on this page.
Oh, wow. Okay. On 154, B2, character of sound, if a noise contains steady audible tone, such as a hum or buzz, rises or falls in pitch or volume, such as a whine or screech, or is a repetitive noise, such as hammering or riveting, and contains music or speech conveying informational content, the maximum noise level will be reduced by 5 decibels. I'm curious as to what the point is of this, and why would you reduce? Because it sounds like that's all noises. So, I mean, what noises are not included in this segment? Mm-hmm. And so why would you offer a reduction? And then on page 155, D, the acoustical study. Again, a question is, who does the study? Is it by a certified analysis and the standards of that study? That's all I have.
Mr. Daniels, anything on 154 and 155?
No, sir.
Commissioner Fuller?
Yeah, I'm just, I must be missing it, but where are we measuring these noise levels?
Where are we measuring these noise levels?
155D.
Acoustical study?
Acoustical study, yeah.
Receptor or locate a noise-sensitive land use near an existing known or potentially known intrusive noise source. Field measurement of noise levels.
The measurement of impacts is a general thing on 1740-040. Page 151.
That's a lot line. Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
There are a number of people that do those studies.
Anything else for you, Mr. Ford?
No, thank you.
Commissioner Maynard?
I will follow up on page 154, B2, character of sound. I have similar concerns as Commissioner Jenkins, and in particular, the one that stood out to me was contains music conveying informational content. I love living in Old Town Goleta because of the music that comes out on Saturdays. I think this should be matched to what the sound is in the area. I don't think there should be a special exception that reduces that by 5 decimals.
Okay. Anything else on these two pages? Nope. I have no comments as well. So we're going to page 156. Commissioner Fuller, you get to lead us off on 156.
I think I'm good.
Okay. Commissioner Maynard?
I have a couple of comments regarding page 156, number 4. I believe that religious groups should be able to sing after 10 and to have... particularly saying their prayers. So I think that would be something I'm a little bit concerned about. The other thing that occurs to me, I think that one was actually fine. Did I miss it then? It was one of no more than 1 minute.
That's a number 4.
Yeah. Okay, that's
one
also
hour.
A number 4.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. So this is the one that I was worried about. Unamplified bells and chimes. My high school growing up had a bell choir. So the bell choir could only practice for 1 minute per hour? That seemed odd to me.
It's talking about clock towers, isn't it?
I think it's trying to talk about clock towers, but yeah. It actually does prohibit bell choirs. Yeah. So I think it needs some work. I'm okay with clock towers being limited. A minute seems kind of restrictive. I think the one on campus sometimes runs for 5 or 6 minutes, but I think for the longer ceremonies, especially if it's unamplified bells, I think it should be okay.
All right. Commissioner Jenkins, where do you?
Nothing on 156.
Commissioner Daniels, where do you on page 156? Anything?
Nothing.
Okay, and I have nothing. All right. So we have just completed that section. Our next one up is signs, and we know that's going to go a long time. What's our preference here? Yes, sir. You're suggesting we go on to the next item?
Yeah.
Okay. Any other, you guys okay with that? Staff? You think we'll get away with that?
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm just going to say that I'm a little bit concerned. I think signs is going to be a longer discussion. It's already 9:15, and I worry about the public sticking around that long. So I'd rather signs move to the next meeting.
Right. I think it's also important for the commission to deal with it all in one and not break it up, because there are some references back and forth.
Okay, so we're going to stop our page through here, and we'll go right to our director and see if we have a director's report this evening.
Very brief. We will be sending out a request to check your schedules for April 18th for a business item meeting, not zoning. But in case we need it for zoning and that item doesn't actually come forward. But I'll have Wendy send you all an email tomorrow so we could see what your schedules look like there. We do have a number of items. They're not ready to come to you, but they are working through the process. So I expect late summer there may be public hearing items unrelated to the zoning ordinance for you to consider. And that's really all I have tonight, unless our advanced planning manager has anything.
No. Okay. Yes, commissioners' comments.
What's the current expectation of when the Shelby project is going to come forward? I know you don't have a specific date yet, but if you just have any general updates for us on that?
No expectation at this time. We don't have any. I'd be making stuff up if I gave you a date. So.
Okay. Any other comments from commissioners?
I just have a question, Mr. Chair, and it's regarding signs for the next time. In our packet anywhere, did we receive the existing sign ordinance?
The existing sign ordinance, no. You received the 2004 zoning ordinance that the DRB drafted as a comment letter. We'll have the existing one for you as well at the next meeting.
Yeah, I think that'd be great.
And just to confirm, you'll be able to send that out in advance of the next meeting so we can do our own comparison?
Yes.
Thanks.
Commissioner Fuller, did you have any comments?
No.
No? Okay. Do I have a motion to adjourn? Goidman, Commissioner Maynard, you're coming back again?
Sorry, one last one. I just want to thank the City of Goleta, who sent Commissioner Fuller and I to the Planning Academy and had a wonderful experience with that, learned a lot, and was also very inspired.
So if I may, thank you also. And it was a lot of great information. Definitely very educational. Thank you much.
Okay. Enough smoothing. Do I have a motion?
So moved.
A second.
A second.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Aye. Okay. The meeting is adjourned. Okay. The meeting is adjourned.